Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in the known universe, all those time zones. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Hello there, everybody. Well, at about 7, shortly after 7:30 this evening, the KNYE telephone began to ring off the hook. And people were saying, oh, my God, it's a UFO, it's a UFO, it's a UFO. Out west here, oh, indeed, there was a UFO shortly after 7:30 this evening. But now it's an IFO, Identified Flying Object. We know what it was, and it was quite spectacular. And by the way, that's, of course, KNYE, our little radio station here in Front Nevada on 95.1. And you can also hear it in Las Vegas, in some parts of Las Vegas anyway, at 100.1. That's 100.1 in parts of Las Vegas. Check it out now. That phone rang and rang and rang. And one lady called and said, are we going to war? Well, that's not as far off base as you might imagine. What was launched was a Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile. It left Vandenberg at 7:36 p.m. It's the perfect time. You know, the sun is just down, but at altitude, the sun is still up. And so when they launch an ICBM at about that time, it gets into the sky and the sun hits it, and it's a two-stager headed off to the Marshall Islands, 4,200 miles, where it was hopefully going to strike the target. You know, the mission was directed by the 576th Flight Test Squadron at Vandenberg and the 341st Space Wing from Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. Purpose to test launch systems and the missile's accuracy and reliability, and it had two unarmed reentry vehicles. So it was really spectacular. Now, what we have done in short order is to put a montage of rocket launch contrail photos. Now, we get those, you know, you as an audience, you're great. And everybody ran out with their cameras. And so from California to Arizona to Nevada, we've got a montage up at this hour of what it looked like out here in the West, so that all of you all over the country can see why people totally freak out. We've got, let me count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 photographs up there presently for you to look at of the rocket launch contrails from Vandenberg today, tonight. It really was cool, and these really are cool photographs. So my thanks, as always, to Keith Rowland, my webmaster, for getting them up just like that. And so we now have an IFO, but it is a beautiful one, and you really need to get on your computer, go to artbell.com under What's New. It would be the very first item. Wherever you are in the country, you can take a look at what we saw out here in the West. Now, since it was an ICBM, what that lady said wasn't so far off target. It's just there weren't enough for them. Now, if you ever see what's depicted here, and you see hundreds of those, then I would say, time to duck and cover. You know, under your desk, hands over the back of your neck, head between the knees, lips pursed. That would be the real McCoy. This wasn't a real McCoy. Well, it was a real McCoy. It just wasn't a war. But it sure looked like it. So if you want to see, I mean, it doesn't matter if you're in Philadelphia and you want to see what we saw out west here that caused the big stir tonight. We've got a wonderful montage of photographs taken all over the Southwest of what a missile launch looks like when it goes up from Vandenberg. Actually, it would be a good idea for everybody to look at this so that you understand what it is that it looks like, and next time you see it, you won't think, it's little green guys. Not this time. In a moment, we'll take a look at what else is going on out there.
Weird stories on the radio? Must be Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, when I started doing this radio program, Jesse, half of the subjects I was really into, paranormal, the unusual, ghosts and things like that.
Yeah.
The conspiracy stories, you know, I was a little weary about these, other than the Kennedy assassination. And all of a sudden, I woke up. I simply woke up. Is that what happened with you too?
Yeah, that's when I really started to say, what is going on here? And I started to truly then investigate 9/11. And today, I don't believe the government story of 9/11. Here's the three options. Either we knew about it and allowed it to happen, or we knew about it and participated in it, or these were the dumbest buffoons that could have ever been in charge of our country, who could have all this pre-information. And I started to think they knew it was going to happen. They either are part of it or they allowed it to. There's no doubt in my mind.
Now we take you back to the night of September 19th, 2002, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
All right, let's look briefly around the rest of the world, see there's some pretty interesting stuff. Oh, tonight, Paul Muller is going to be here. The Sky Car, Paul Muller. Now, all my life, I have dreamed about the public having a Sky Car. And I, you know, a car you could go out and get into and just hit lift off and up you go and away you go. Now, if I had that here, Las Vegas, you know, 65 miles, not as the crow flies, but as you've got to drive, just over the mountain. If I had a Sky Car, 20 minutes, I'd be in Las Vegas. From the time I hit the button, maybe less. Oh, God, I would love it. Well, Paul Muller, who's the CEO of that company, came on the show. You know, it's got to be a year and a half, 2 years ago. And he has not wanted to come on since, because he didn't want to come on until he had news, good news, about the Sky Car. Tonight, he comes with good news, and we'll all take a look at it and talk to him about what's coming and whether there's a possibility that we might have it in our lifetime. Wouldn't that be cool? Goodbye to paved roads. Goodbye. Now, there are certain things that, you know, you've got to consider. I mean, if everybody was flying around in the sky, it could be chaos. And so we'll talk about all of that, but, boy, give me a Sky Car any day of the week. So that's what we're going to talk about in the next hour. We'll have partial open lines this hour. Our president asked Congress today for authority to, quote, use all means, end quote, including military force, if necessary, to disarm and overthrow Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein if he does not quickly meet U.N. demands that he abandoned all weapons of mass destruction. At the UN, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein delivered a defiant written message taunting the U.S., bad idea, while claiming that Iraq has no chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons, saying that he welcomes inspections to prove it. So, I wonder if we're going to have a war. A Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up on a crowded Tel Aviv bus, killed five people, and Israeli tanks went right on back to Yasser Arafat's West Bank compound, and no doubt he at this hour is looking down the barrel of an Israeli tank gone. They're great, real big. They're big, you know. You ever got hit with one of those, it would just knock you in half or blow your head off or whatever, and so it's got to be a little intimidating to look out your window and see one of those Israeli, or several of those Israeli tanks, would have big holes staring you right in the face. That's what he's got at this hour. Now, in Cuba, look out, Cuba. There's a big hurricane named Isidore gathering strength, and it's headed right toward Cuba's western tip and the small, what's called the Isle of Youth. Now they're boarding up everything there. Check this out. When it hits shortly, Isidore should dump perhaps over 2 feet of rain, up to 30 inches of rain on Cuba. That's one hell of a lot of rain and trouble headed for Cuba. And then where she goes from there, only the National Weather Service knows. Maybe. Maybe. Do you think we have the power to direct hurricanes? Been wondering about that for some time. Do we have the power to direct major weather systems to divert hurricanes? There's some not very good evidence that that may have been done, that there already may have been hurricanes diverted from the east coast of the U.S. Some of the tracks are interesting, speculatively interesting. Would we divert one from smacking Cuba? Oh, probably not. What do you think? Coming from MSNBC, Area 51, Truth Seekers, zero. That's a Area 51, Truth Seekers, zero. For more than four decades now, an unusual alliance of mainstream lawyers, conspiracy theorists, and UFO enthusiasts have tried to find out just what the hell's going on out at Groom Lake, Nevada. They didn't say, hell, I did the top security Air Force facility, better known to fans of the X-Files as Area 51. Now they're going to have to wait at least another year since our president, President George Bush, reissued an executive order Wednesday which bars the disclosure of any information to anybody for any reason about that site. Where some say, well, nothing's going on anymore. But even lawyers who are trying to sue on behalf of workers claiming they've been harmed in some way from having worked at the non-existent place, they can't get any info. Because the president, on September 18th, and as it has been every year since 1995, signed the order to make sure that nobody finds out anything about Area 51 that doesn't exist. Yucca Mountain. This is a very interesting article in UFO magazine. I thought it was extremely interesting. You know, this nuclear waste that we have is going to have to be maintained for, you know, like maybe 100,000 years or something like that. And so, you know, 100,000 years, I mean, we... 100,000 years, I mean, it's going to be at toxic, dangerous, horrible levels for 100,000 years. Now, how much time in the human race can we account for right now? Huh? With record keeping and all that. Since Christ? Before that even? 10,000 years? No. Not really. We can't really account for much over when Christ walked, I mean, in some ways, but they're pretty sketchy, aren't they? So the human race doesn't have experience yet with 10,000 years, much less with 100,000 years. Now, that thought in mind, there have been recommendations made about what should be done with regard to leaving messages for the future human race in every conceivable language, every conceivable way to communicate, that this is a bad area, that you should not go there. They'll have messages on the walls, near the nuclear material itself, and in chambers, before you get to the nuclear material. In fact, some of the recommendations include things like creation of an atomic priesthood. It would be a self-perpetuating caste of scientists who would be entrusted with keeping knowledge of the site alive no matter what happens to humanity. An atomic priesthood. Something that would have to be passed down to all generations of whatever mutants come along on our planet. All we know, humans as we know them now, in 100,000 years, might be just little balls of light flitting around. Energy. Nothing more. Even so, the warnings will have to be there, and they will have to be maintained. They will have to be carried forth generation after generation after generation for 100,000 years. So we're going to have to create myths. We're going to have to create religions around this. So it will be a verboten area. It will be thought of as evil. It will be thought of as Pandora's box. And they're officially going to do this. So, they'll be building myths around the when they start begin to bury this stuff in about 10 years. Now, I know that you know about this, or if you don't, you should. The report coming out very late, I think George had this on the other night, that the Chernobyl plant. We now find out, isn't this interesting, so many years later, had a UFO hovering over it for hours, hours and hours, before the explosion. Now, I'm told here that it could have been a lot worse. It really could have been a lot worse. In fact, it could have been so much worse that had it gone up another way, if that UFO hadn't been there, much of what you see on the map in Europe wouldn't be on the map in Europe at all. So bad as it was, and it was bad, nobody would ever question that, it could have been far worse had it not been for the appearance of, believe it or not, a UFO. And we find all this out 16 years later, and still in the UFO category. Here's a very interesting case for you, and I'm just going to read it to you as is. It was called to my attention by Whitley Strieber. Very interesting story. On August 2nd, a witness saw a UFO above Montour Ridge in Northumberland, Pennsylvania. Now, it hovered above power lines, directed a beam of blue and white light to the ground. Next, he saw what appeared to be a man suspended in the light, being pulled up toward the UFO head first. The man was moving his arms slowly in the light, seemed to be pulled up into the bottom of the craft. A few minutes later, the UFO flew west rapidly, stopped again briefly, then flew straight up and out of sight. 2 days later, check this out. The body of 39-year-old Todd Sees, that's S-E-E-S, was found nearby. Sees lived at the base of Montour Ridge and went up the mountain on his four-wheeler to look for deer. He told his wife he'd be home by noon. Left home at a little after 5 a.m. His wife began to get worried around noon. Search party organized at 2 p.m. Local state police, paramedics, 200 volunteers. In the evening of the second day, something white was spotted in a large, brushy area 25 feet from the pond. Police and rescue workers spent 20 minutes cutting and hacking brush and small trees so they could reach what looked like a body. It turned out to be the white, emaciated body of Todd Sees. It wasn't bloated, so he appeared not to have drowned, nor had he been in the pond for any great length of time. His face had an expression of horror on it. He was wearing only underwear, despite having been fully dressed when he left his house. The FBI arrived within 30 minutes, took charge of the whole case. Questioning area residents, three farmers said they saw a large, round, bright object hovering around the power lines at the time of that disappearance. It was silent and didn't move for about 10 to 15 minutes. Then it shot up and suddenly stopped again. A light shone down and something was pulled up into the light. It then shot up again, hesitated, and flew out of sight. One farmer said the UFO appeared out of nowhere, and he could see flying sparks from the power line tower as it hovered overhead. The entire incident lasting about 10 minutes before the UFO got very bright and took off, flying low. His horses were very upset and nervous for about 12 hours after the incident. When the body was autopsied, no cause of death was found. Two rattlesnakes were spotted in the area, but toxicology tests ruled any of that out, as well as drugs or any other toxins. There were no signs of foul play. There were no visible cuts or bruises on the body except from the brush. One of his boots was discovered in the top of a tree 1 mile from where the four-wheeler was found. Now, this is a pretty wild story, and, it's really what you would have to call a possible murder by a UFO. A possible murder by a UFO. Now, this story is on Whitley Strieber's Unknown Country website, and if you want to go and find it, you go to unknowncountry.com and then put in the search engine Sees, S-E-E-S, that's man's name, allegedly, Sees, S-E-E-S. And the story will come right up, and you can read it for yourself. But it does look like, if all this is real, that it's the first pretty well-documented alleged murder by a UFO. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, tonight's ICBM launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base is documented in photography from all of you. On my website right now, artbell.com, under What's New, we've got a collage of pictures, so anybody anywhere in the world can take a look. Go to my website. You will see what we saw out here in the West. Pretty cool stuff. Very cool stuff, actually. Now, if you ever see a lot of those at once, hundreds of those at once, then you might start thinking about war, because that's what it might be. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 19, 2002. Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 19, 2002.
Good evening, everybody. And those are the numbers. If you want to get on the air, we're going to do about 30 minutes of open lines. Just ahead of Paul Mohler telling us what's new with the Sky Car. This is my dream machine, the Sky Car. So we'll get into all of that here shortly. Strange things occurring in the studio. Ah, well.
Take you back to the night of September 19th, 2002, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Well, all right, as I said, open lines now, directly ahead. Anything you want to talk about is absolutely fair game. And let us begin with the wild card line. You are on the air. Hi there.
Hi, Art. This is Jim from Commerce, Michigan. I listen to you on CKLW out of Windsor, Canada.
How you doing, Jim?
Pretty good tonight. I was very interested in your program last night with a guest you had talking about the marijuana issue out there, your ballot initiative.
Oh, here in Nevada, yes.
Yeah, we had a similar issue that we've been trying to get on the ballot for several, last, I think, 3 years here in Michigan. We call it the PRA, the Personal Responsibility Act.
Right.
So it's quite, you know, it's a very similar thing. Just about all the police officers we get, that we ever meet, they all sign the petition.
Sure.
They're all sick and tired of this, the baloney that's going on.
I know.
And, you know, we kind of got into some of the history about how this thing, this law was passed in 1937, some of the shenanigans that went on in Congress, how the, head of the American Medical Association pleaded with Congress not to do this.
I know.
You can get this out of the congressional
record. I know. But you know the funny thing, sir? All of that happened then. That was then. This is now. We're
I think we're enlightened since those days. But the action the action of our government since those days has not become enlightened. Only the people.
Absolutely. It's amazing how enlightened the government became just a couple of years after they passed this law in 1937, because it went from having no law whatsoever against it to being a Class A narcotic that doctors couldn't even prescribe.
What I'm trying to say, sir, is that none of that has changed. It's still, we've got the drug czar and billions of dollars fighting this insane battle, this utterly insane battle that's putting people in jail, getting people arrested, giving people records, all for something that is not even as dangerous in any documentable way as the legal drug we have now, alcohol. It's insanity.
Oh, absolutely.
To be wasting all this money on it and to be misleading our poor children who then will go to other drugs. I hate the whole damn thing.
Are you aware of what's happened in England in the last few months?
No, why?
They have practically, they've decriminalized it. They're not even looking for people who smuggled in the country anymore. And I understand several other countries, Western Europe, are looking at doing the same thing. At one time in this country, back when the West was being settled, every wagon that went west from St. Joe, Missouri and St. Louis, Missouri, had canvas on it from cannabis. Mm-hmm. They all had rope made from hemp, and the oil in the axles were made from hemp oil.
Yeah. You don't need to convince me. The Wall Street Journal, a number of years ago, did an article on the legalization of hemp, not just cannabis to smoke, but hemp in general. And at that time, it said the economy would realize about $500 billion, that's $500 billion from the legalization of hemp. And, of course, during the war, we had hemp for war. I mean, we had to have hemp. So this whole insane war has really, it's time for it to come to an end. It's time for the madness to end. That's what I think the slogan ought to be. That's what I keep pushing. You used to call it a reefer madness, right? Well, now it's time for the madness to end. And the madness is coming from Washington. It's coming from our drug czar, from our administration. And it's just a pile of steaming poo. And so it's time we changed all this and began to get realistic and stop lying to our children. And stop making it easier for them to go on to other drugs, which are damn well dangerous and addictive. No drug should be touted as a good thing, not alcohol, not smoking, not marijuana. No drug should be encouraged, period. However, in the real world, people use them. People go to cocktail parties. People have a drink. Some people prefer a little wine, and some people prefer a little marijuana. And all things told, marijuana is less harmful to society and to individuals in general than alcohol. So, really, it's time to end the madness. And I hope my state is the first one to take the step. I'd be very proud if that were so. I urge people to think about it. Nevada has always been a forward-looking, forward-doing state that does things that other states won't do. And I have this funny feeling that this time, we're going to do it again. East of the Rockies, you are on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Art. This is Jeff in Indiana. I'm listening to you on XM Satellite Radio.
Oh, yes, sir.
And I want to pass on greetings and salutations from one of your many, many chat rooms. It's Dalnet, and it's the Real Art Bell chat room. We all just wanted to say hi to you.
Okay, thank you.
And I wanted to comment on this picture on your website that you have the three pilots holding the guns, and it says, welcome to the flight deck, Mohammed. That just cracked me up. I just like that so much.
In that case, sir, you should like this. Listen carefully.
Good afternoon. This is your captain speaking with just a little flight information. Coming up on the left, we're going to be catching a glimpse of the Grand Canyon. On the right, you can be able to see the Hoover Dam in just a few minutes. We're flying at an altitude of 37,000 feet, and our airspeed is 400 miles an hour. A couple little facts here. I'm packing a Colt King Cobra. That's a .357 caliber firearm with a black rubber grip and a 6-inch barrel. Also, the co-pilot is carrying a Kimber custom defense pistol with all the bells and whistles you'd expect from a custom gun of that kind, with an alloy frame and bevel treatment on the entire gun. And our chief flight attendant, Roger, has a Ruger Bearcat, that 22, with a hand-fluted cylinder. All three are capable of piercing body armor at a distance of up to 27 feet, and it can put a hole in human bone and flesh the size of the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, is coming up on the left-hand side of the plane, so just sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of the flight.
That's great. That is so great.
Anyway, it conveys the vocal message that cartoon does otherwise.
Okay, Art, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Take care. I have thought, since the beginning, that in conjunction with fortifying the doors so they can't be just kicked in, you know, to the cockpit, I think that's underway right now. I hope it is. That the pilots ought to be able to protect themselves. And, people argue, and I get all these emails, oh, my God, Art, don't you realize that a bullet would go through the skin of the aircraft? Yes, and there could be even explosive decompression as a result. However, I argue now, as I argued and have argued since day one, that while that's bad, it's not hardly as bad as hitting the ground at 525 miles an hour. I mean, there's definite consequences to hitting the ground at 525 miles an hour, or a building, or anything else, or a mountain, side of a mountain, sir. They're real bad. So having our pilots and co-pilots and flight crew being able to carry guns to protect themselves and the passengers has always seemed to me to be a pretty good idea. West of the Rockies, you are on the air. Hello.
Hi, good evening, Art. Richard here from Over the Hill in Las Vegas, KDWN.
Yes, sir.
I loved listening to that. I could just picture the stewardess showing rubber mock-ups of the gun, of each gun.
Yeah. That's right. As they, just like they demonstrate the flotation devices and point out where the doors are, they hold up a big rubber gun, as the pilot described it. That's very good, sir.
Exactly. I have a couple questions from last night. My trusty VersaCorder was not on. Mm. And while Bonnie was on...
Well, now, wait a minute, sir. Let's be careful here. The VersaCorder is trustworthy. Its operator, however, probably forgot to set something on the trusty VersaCorder.
You're right. I wasn't on. It is my fault entirely.
Okay. Cockpit error.
Exactly. Yeah. My question is, I have two questions perhaps you could answer. I don't know if she went over this or not. What was the deepest man-made hole she may have found, and did she retrieve any artifacts from any of the holes that she'd been in?
Well, with regard to the deepest she's found, that would have been in Peru. Now, she did mention artifacts. She didn't get specific about what artifacts she had found. She said they leave them intact where they are. With regard to the deepest hole, she said it. In fact, the Russians are the ones who have drilled the deepest hole, and there's one hell of a story that goes with it. Now, the Russians drilled a hole so deep, this was we've got the story somewhere, and I every time I do this, I bring the story back. It was a Reuters story, that's what it was, Reuters. About these Russians who drilled the deepest hole in the world. Now, Reuters went on to say that after they got down, God knows how far, they lowered microphones. This was all allegedly in Siberia. They lowered microphones into this hole, and the scientists did some recording. And as the story goes, after they heard this recording, they stopped drilling the hole. The scientists split. The whole project ended. Now, some years ago, I was sent what purports to be what was recorded in that hole. And now, maybe when you hear it here, you're going to perhaps understand why those scientists split and why the project ended. Anyway, all of that happened. Now, if this is indeed the legit audio from that, I think you'll understand why they freaked out. Here's what they heard. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what we affectionately call the voices from hell. Now, I know it seems ludicrous, but again, Reuters reported the details. This audio followed to me a few years ago, and I hold this pretty close to the vest. This was a really deep hole. And after hearing that, everybody took off. Now, whatever else you think, if you heard that recording and you were a scientist and you had been part of the drilling team, what would you do? Would you stick around? Would you go over and put your ear to the hole to see if you could personally hear it? Huh? Probably not, right? I don't know. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
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 Hello, yeah, I was calling. My name is Josh. I'm calling from Los Banos,
yes.
California.
Yes, Josh.
And about 7:15 to 7:25 this evening.
It was actually 7:36, my friend.
7:36.
Yeah.
We were wondering what that was that we seen.
Hmm. What do you think you saw?
Well, we were thinking it was something launched from Vandenberg.
Well, you're exactly right. It was at 7:36, actually, Josh. And it was a Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile delivering... we hope, accurately, to the Marshall Islands, its payload. That was an ICBM you saw.
Yeah, because we've seen it burst into
That was the second stage you saw going.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to see really good pictures of it, Josh, you go to my website, artbell.com, under What's New, First Item. We've got a whole collage of pictures of people who saw it all over the Southwest, and they went and got their cameras. So compare that to what you saw.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care, Josh. You bet. Wildcard Line, you are on the air. Good morning.
Yes, this is Dr. Daniel in Omaha, Nebraska, speaking of the Air Force.
Yes, sir.
STRATCOM and the Future Space Command.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask you a question. They were talking about a UFO over Chernobyl.
Yes.
And with a beam and so on. Did you know that the Air Force has a airborne laser system?
I was vaguely aware of such a thing, yes.
Yeah, they had a lot of 747s sitting around, and they decided to outfit them so that they could take on the terrorists.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't doubt for one second that we've got all kinds of things ready. Now, if war breaks out, I expect that really good observers are going to see all kinds of things happen that people have never seen happen before, and we're going to bring out all the newest stuff.
Yeah, I figure we'd be experimenting again.
Yeah.
You have a good evening.
All right, sir. You too. Take care. East of the Rockies, you are on the air. Hello.
Is this Art?
It is. Please turn your radio off if it's on and proceed.
What's up, Art? This is Jeff from Sumter, South Carolina.
Okay,
sir. I listen to you on WDXY 1040.
In Sumter?
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
And I've got two things. You know, you're talking about the flying car and all.
Yes. Yes.
That put... on my mind, you know, my favorite movie, Back to the Future 2.
Yes.
And also, you remind me of, like, Dan Aykroyd whenever he laughs.
Really?
When he's doing Tom Snyder.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You have a good night, too, sir, and thank you very much. Reminds him of Dan Aykroyd when I laugh. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Oh, Art.
Oh, yes. Turn your radio off.
Wow, yeah, I turned it off.
Okay, here you are. Where are you?
This is Kevin in Tempe, Arizona.
Yes, Kevin.
You know, I was curious, Art, what year did that Siberian experiment supposedly take place?
You know, that was in the Reuters story, and I'm really sorry, but unless we dredge it up, and I can do that. Keith, I'm sure, has it socked away. We brought it back numerous times, and we can find out.
Maybe you can just ballpark it.
I think it was a long time ago. It seems like it was a long time ago, fairly long ago anyway. Maybe the 80s comes to mind.
Yeah, because I had heard about it prior to your show, which...
It was news. It made news everywhere.
Yeah, that's interesting.
What do you...
Well, thank you, sir.
Well, no, wait, before you go.
Oh.
What do you think about what you heard? Now, if you were part of the drilling team...
Well, that's hilarious, you asked that.
If you were part of the team when they played it, you know, in the room with a bunch of scientists huddled around, you were one of those guys, what would you have done?
Well, I'll tell you what. The first time I heard it, I was totally spooked out.
Yeah.
But as I listened to it recently, it's sounding more and more like Grand Central Station.
It could be. Yeah, it does, except for the screams. Now,
yeah,
I don't know about those.
There's almost a couple of discernible words in there. I suppose if you sent that to...
But my question, nevertheless, sir, was if that's what you heard on the desk in Russia, in Siberia, and you were one of the scientists who heard that, what would you do?
I'd be looking for my next project.
Yeah, well, all right, thank you. See, that's no small matter, because in Russia, it's very hard to get and keep jobs, and even some of the best scientists are not employed, you know. Wildcard line, you are on the air. Good evening, without a whole lot of time here till the top of the hour.
Yeah, I just want to tell you about a UFO sighting my daughter had.
That your daughter had?
Yeah, she's 10-year-old. She showed it to me, actually.
Wait a minute, she's 10 years old?
Yes. It was about 7:30 in the evening, about 2 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was a large rectangular object flying about jet altitude, maybe a little bit higher. And I was just wondering if maybe anyone else had ever had seen it. It was down in Tennessee.
Oh, sir, listen. My own sighting that I had with my wife was of a triangular object not as far away. So, you know, there's no question about it. These triangles, whatever in the hell they are, they're flying in our skies. They might be our triangles, or they might be somebody else's triangles, but triangles they are, make no mistake about it, and they are flying in our skies and flying in the skies of Europe, Scandinavia, all over the world. These triangles have been reported hundreds, no, make that thousands of times, these flying triangles. They make no noise. They don't fly, as in aerodynamic flight. They float, as in defying gravity or defying air. That, you know, people said, well, they're balloons of some kind. I don't think so. I had one go right over my head. There was nothing balloon-like about it at all. It actually looked rather metallic and real heavy and not real likely to float at about 30 miles an hour. Float is a, you know, an understatement. What that thing did was defy gravity, and they're really out there. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002. Presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired September 19th, 2002.
Close your eyes and try and imagine going out to your driveway. Actually, you wouldn't even need a driveway. You could have a pad, right? Going out to whatever you've got outside your house, opening the door, hopping into your Sky car, and then going shopping, setting it for the following coordinates, GPS probably or whatever, and then just push the button and away you go in the air like Superman. The reality is coming up on the program now. Dr. Paul S. Muller is my guest, and it's been, a year and a half, 2 years, I don't know, a long time since we had Dr. Mueller on, because he wanted to bring you new information about his Sky Car. Tonight you're going to get it. Dr. Mueller grew up on a rural chicken ranch in southeastern B.C., British Columbia, Canada. Now, we have a chicken ranch here, too. Oh, those legs. At a very early age, it became apparent that Paul had a natural ability and desire to engineer and construct things. By the age of 11, the dream of flight had already taken him far along the path that he'd followed throughout his whole life. So he built, I guess, a Ferris wheel, which would enable him to simulate flight. We'll have to ask about that. By the time Paul turned 15, he had built a dozen sports cars to get him from place to place. Though already successful, his dream was still unrealized, so undaunted, he designed his first helicopter and began its construction that same year. The helicopter, clearly not an exactly ideal flying machine for the general public, provided reason enough to continue along his chosen path toward what is now Sky Car. Paul Mueller received a Master of Engineering from McGill University in 1961, Ph.D. in Aerodynamics from McGill in 1963. He knows what he's talking about. Dr. Mueller was a professor of mechanical and aeronautical engineering at the University of California, Davis, 63 to 75, where he developed the aeronautical engineering program. In 72, he founded Supertrap Industries and was also chief executive officer of that subsidiary until it was sold in 88. He also organized and led the group, which developed ultimately the Davis Research Park Complex between 75 and 83. He founded Mueller International and has served as the company's president, CEO, and chairman of the board since its formation in 83. As a spinoff of Mueller Corporation to continue to design, develop, manufacture, and market personal, vertical, takeoff, and landing aircraft. The company has developed and integrated the disparate technologies required for small powered lift VTOL aircraft, Sky Cars, folks. These include electronic stabilization and control systems, efficient ducted fan designs, a thrust vectoring mechanisms, and aerodynamically stable composite airframe structures. The single most significant spin-off technology is the rotopower engine, the Wankel rotary engine. I had a car with a Wankel engine. It's cool. In 1999, Mueller International completed the development, test, and production of the rotary power engine required in the Sky Car. Subsequently, the engine was licensed to Freedom Motors, a spin-off of Mueller International, for all applications except aircraft and ducted fans. After over 30 years, Dr. Mueller's dream to create a versatile, low-maintenance, easy-to-operate, fast, and economically viable, safe, environmentally responsible VTOL transportation solution is now at hand. The M400 Sky Car is a transportation solution. The M400 Sky Car incorporates the flexibility of taking off and landing from nearby any location with safety and ease of operation by the general public. So he's talking about all of us. In a moment.
Streamlink, the audio subscription service of Coast to Coast AM, has a new name, Coast Insider. You'll still get all the same great features for the same low price, just 15 cents a day when you sign up for 1 year. The package includes podcasting, which offers the convenience of having shows downloaded automatically to your computer or MP3 player, and the iPhone app with live and on-demand programs. You'll also get our amazing download library of 3 full years of shows. Just think, as a new subscriber, over 1,000 shows will be available for you to collect, enjoy, and listen to at your leisure. Plus, you'll get streamed and on-demand broadcasts of Art Bell's Somewhere in Time shows and 2 weekly classics. And as a member, you'll have access to our monthly live chat sessions with George Norrie and special guests. If you're a fan of Coast, you won't want to be without Coast Insider. Visit coasttocoastam.com to sign up today. Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
When you look at what's going on around this planet, it's almost as if someone has got a playbook to try to control all these countries all of a sudden. I've always said that not everything is a conspiracy, but a lot of it is.
You know, when you start looking into things, there's only a certain set of conclusions you can reach, and unfortunately, this is one of them. You know, it's very, very hard not to see things like that when you start looking at things in a larger picture.
Now we take you back to the night of September 19th, 2002, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Well, there are certain things in life that become passions. They become compulsions, and flight is one of those things, isn't it, Doctor?
Yeah, I guess it certainly has been for me.
Becomes a compulsion isn't an unfair word, is it? The whole concept and the feeling of wanting to fly is like a compulsion, huh?
Yeah, I guess it varies a little bit between one type of flying and another. I was never desirous of flying in a conventional airplane. I always wanted to imitate the hummingbird. That special ability they had to take off vertically, fly backwards and forwards, and accelerate like a Ferrari Testarossa.
And hover.
And hover, which is the most critical part.
I was in San Francisco at the International Airport, and a hummingbird came up and hovered in front of my wife's mouth, and actually came forward very gently while it was hovering and touched her lip. And then backed away. I've never seen anything like it in my life, but hovering like that, huh?
That's amazing. I haven't seen anything like that either, but that
was amazing. How long have you been dreaming, Doctor, really, of the sky car? I mean, of the concept, since early on?
I think when I started designing the helicopter when I was about 15, I had really clearly identified something I wanted to do. I had built a number of things before that, but there was a real, in that part of the world in which I lived, it was pretty rural, and getting anywhere was quite difficult. In the wintertime, you had to walk through the snow through a couple miles to get to school, so the idea of that kind of mobility where you could go where you want, when you want, like a hummingbird, was very exciting.
How did you do with your helicopter? I mean, not everybody builds a helicopter. That's a pretty big story all by itself.
Well, right? I didn't really complete it. I mean, I was much more optimistic, and I guess that's characteristic of people who end up doing or trying to do what I've been trying to do, where you underestimate how complicated it is and how long it might take. I'm certainly a champion at that. but I did build part of the helicopter. In fact, interesting enough, the one part that was used by my father was the tail system when our hatchery, the power shut down on our hatchery on the farm, and the heat rises in that situation, and it kills the baby chicks before they're hatched, of course. And so he hooked up my tail rotor from my helicopter to an electric motor powered by, of course, a battery, and managed to keep the air circulating enough that he kept 25,000 chicks alive.
So it
so it got some use.
It got some good use. So then the sky car, we've got pictures of the Model 400, the new M400 design on the website tonight. A million people are going to go look at it because it is in-blinking credible, folks. When you see it, wait till they see it. This is a personal flying vehicle designed to be used by the general public, isn't it?
That's
right?
Correct. That's the thing that's really important. It's designed to be particularly safe and to be inexpensive in mass production, so that, in theory, everybody can use it, perhaps as an air taxi, as a rental vehicle, or as something one could own.
Imagine for me that everything goes well. You go into production, you begin to mass produce these at the level of Ford or Chrysler or something like that. If you were to imagine that, what do you imagine today's price would be when it rolled off the assembly line?
We've done some actual fairly extensive analysis of that, and we're so much today the beneficiary of low-cost computer technology, software and hardware, and what we've really done in this vehicle is replace much of the typical mechanical hardware, which is, of course, the expensive part of any aircraft, with this electronic software, which is cheap. You're talking about a vehicle that could be in the price of a quality automobile, $10,000, perhaps even less. It gets difficult to estimate when you get that low, but it's in that region.
So like Mercedes are cheaper even, huh?
Yeah, actually it's a mid-price Mercedes, I suppose.
Mid-price Mercedes. And for that money, you might get something that looks like the M400? I mean, is that...
Yeah, it would be a four-passenger vehicle. It would be... We would obviously be building two passengers and six passenger vehicles, which is pretty much the maximum you can build.
Sure, but the one we're talking about here would be four passenger life.
That's the common one. That would be the one that would be the most commonly used, right?
So you could carry four, you could safely carry four people. That's kind of like, you know, a small sedan.
That's correct.
Okay. How do you manage to lift the weight of four people and whatever they've brought along safely, vertically into the air, and then begin transporting them horizontally and then landing again? How do you, what has to happen to do that? That's a lot of weight.
The first thing you have to do is become a mechanical hummingbird, which means you have to have a pretty high metabolism in the form of a lot of power. And that was the critical thing for us. That took us the last 10 years. People have often asked, you know, why weren't you flying this 400 10 years ago? And we actually had the airframe and the undercarriage and everything built, but we didn't have engines that were powerful enough to be able to lift it off and lift it off safely and be able to tolerate an engine failure, for example, or some other kind of failure that would allow you to continue to operate safely.
Okay, so how did you get that? How did you finally get the breakthrough point where you had enough engine to build it?
Well, we developed this engine over many years. We've been in the engine business longer, actually, than I've really been in the aircraft construction business.
Uh-huh.
We started that 40 years ago, and we've had a continuous engine development program. Since then, we've also acquired most of the rotary or Wankel engine technology that was ever developed in America, including the production equipment. So we've been fortunate enough to put ourselves in a position to produce these particular very small engines, not much bigger than something you can hold. Certainly, you can hold it with your two hands. 160 horsepower engine.
So then you're saying the Wankel engine was the answer?
The Wankel engine was the answer. It's interesting. The Wankel engine really never found a home other than in some limited sports cars from Mazda, but I think it was always waiting for this kind of technology because there is no other engine that would be cost effective. You can put a turbine in, but it'd be extremely expensive.
I owned a Mazda Wankel engine car. I had one for years. And you know what the really interesting thing was that I found out about it? I'm always one of those nuts who puts a compass right up front, you know, so I see which way I'm going because I hardly know. So I always put a compass on my cars, always. And I put a compass on that one, and I found out the Wankel engine produces a magnetic field.
Is that right?
And it would permanently freeze my compass toward the Wankel engine. Over a period of time, it finally froze that thing toward the Wankel engine. Have you ever noticed that about the Wankel?
No, I've never had that condition. We have, of course, any of the electronics we have in the vehicle are extremely heavily shielded because of the dangers of any kind of magnetic field, whether it's from the engine
or
from stray electric fields. So we're very well protected and probably wouldn't pick up on that.
But the Wankel engine was such a wonderful engine, and it, as you point out, it was in the Mazda, and then it just went away. And my first question is, why?
Well, it was in a specialized vehicle that ended up being quite expensive over a period of time as it became more of a high-performance car, and I think eventually it just didn't have a big enough market. It is coming back, and it certainly is timely. It'll be back this fall or early spring, with another extra 75 horsepower, a beautiful new design.
Oh, really?
Just at the right time for the world to believe again in the rotary engine. And, of course, it's not bad for our project either to have that happening.
What are the advantages of a rotary engine over the standard piston engine thing?
Well, the major advantage, say, if you're starting out with a new technology or a new engine, is that it's extremely simple. In our aircraft, there's only two moving parts. Whereas in a typical engine of the same capability, a piston four-stroke engine, you'd have about 46 moving parts. So there's a reliability issue. But the other things are that you get an awful lot of power in a very small package. The engine is extremely reliable for anybody who's really had a lot of experience with it.
So pound for pound, how much more horsepower does the Wankel produce?
Well, we generate regularly 2 horse per pound. Your automotive engine probably produces a half a horsepower per pound.
Wow.
So there's about a factor of four there.
That's big.
Between the two of them.
Yeah, it's big. About 400% more.
Right, and it's true of the aircraft engines produced today. They produce about a half a horsepower per pound. Some of them a little bit more than that, but never one horsepower per pound, and we can operate at two.
In the M400 design, God, this looks like, you know, a futuristic sports car. It looks like some Bruce Willis be in. How many Wankel engines are in there?
We use eight small engines, as I said, not much bigger, something you could hold very easily in two hands. You could almost hold it in one hand. They're all integrated with a computer, so it's not like you're really dealing with eight engines. The beauty is that, of course, one engine can fail, and the vehicle will continue to operate. And we've had that recently when we were flying the 400. This is early on, of course. Things do go wrong, and we had an engine that did not operate, and we continue to fly the aircraft.
Safely.
Safely, yes. It's still in one piece.
That's incredible. So you actually have proven that in flights.
Yes, we did it earlier, too, with the earlier two-passenger, what we call the M200. We lost an engine in that in flight at one point and didn't actually discover that loss until the vehicle had actually landed.
The M400 is beautiful. I mean, it's just flat. Easy on the eye, I guess you'd put it that way. In other words, you go to my website, folks, artbell.com. Go to program, tonight's guest information, and there you'll see Dr. Paul Mueller's name. Now, the first thing you'll see is related info, new M400 design. Now, look at it, and when you look at it, Americans buy stuff, cars, because they're sold on the aesthetic beauty and performance of what they're buying. And in the M400, you'll have them. I mean, this thing is beautiful. You start drooling when you look at it. I do, anyway. You've got to wipe off the drool. Oh, that is some machine. Who actually did the design that we're looking at here, Doctor?
Well, you know, it's a funny combination. Form tends to follow function in aerodynamics. If things work and fly smoothly through the air, they typically look pretty good. But my major in high school, let's say the course I did the best in is art. So I suppose in a funny kind of way, art is something that I've always been very involved in and very interested in. I come from a family where my sisters are outstanding artists. So I got a little help there along the line from heredity, I suppose.
But, well, not to mention your PhD in aerodynamics. So.
Well, that's the technical part. But yeah. The aesthetic part, I tried to encompass as much as I could without getting beyond what clearly is needed to be a very successful vehicle.
There are some exceptions to aerodynamic and beautiful. I mean, there are some ugly things that fly, and this happens to be, I mean, you would have to look at this as a sports air car, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, it certainly has sports car capabilities, and you're right, it does look fairly sporty.
Oh, it's got sports car written all over it. And it's also got, when you look at it, it's got fast written all over it.
It's fast. It's very fast.
Is it? How fast is it?
Well, top speed is 380, and at 25,000 feet is capable of cruising well over 300 miles an hour.
Oh, really?
And do quite well. I mean, it's a high performance. It's not a jet plane, of course, but it has a lot of the characteristics of a jet plane. Small wings, which means it doesn't get upset by the environment. It can be windy or gusty, and the vehicle can fly through that kind of condition.
And that's because of small wings?
Small wings, right. You see, you normally have large wings because you have to take off from a runway. You really don't want large wings, but that's the only way you can fly slow speed.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting big wing story when we get back. We're at the bottom of the hour, Dr. Mueller. Stay right there. Yeah, big wings and turbulence. I've got a couple stories about that. He's right about that. Big wings. Look at it. It's got a small wing. You're going to want to see this. So go to my website and take a look and see a new M400 design, the sky car that Dr. Mueller is building for you and me.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 19, 2002. listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 19, 2002.
My guest is Dr. Paul Mahler, and he's the inventor, manufacturer of the Sky Car. You can see the M400 design on my website right now. I suggest you do that under tonight's guest info. M400, it is a real drool machine. I mean, it's you've got to have one, right? That's the kind of deal it is. Now, we're talking about big wings. I'll tell you a story about big wings in a moment.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002.
A few years ago, Ramona and me were on the way, but we left Narita Airport in Tokyo, and we were on our way back to the States. You know, we were going to land in San Francisco, I think, or somewhere or another. Anyway, we got over we're in a 747. They have real big wings. And we got over the Alaskan area, because, of course, you're doing the Northwest Passage. And we hit turbulence. Now, this wasn't just any turbulence. This was rip the wings off kind of turbulence. I mean, your head would hit the ceiling if you weren't to, you know, have the seatbelt on. Things were flying around the cabin. The poor little stewardesses, the JAL stewardesses, the cute little JAL stewardesses, they were all turning totally white and other shades. And when you look over at the stewardess and she's, you know, sitting and buckled in and turning colors, then you know you're in turbulence. That was serious turbulence. So, like, big wings, big turbulence. But this Sky Car could perhaps not run into that level of turbulence, but some fairly serious turbulence without suddenly going down like a rock. And why is that? Why can it, other the small wings, but what about the power system itself? In other words, you wonder as this vehicle lifts and as this vehicle moves forward, how it achieves its stable flight. And to be given to the general public, of course, it'd have to be very stable and relatively safe. So how does it achieve that? Especially with small wings.
Well, as I said earlier, you have big wings normally, or larger wings than you would like to have, simply because you have to take off from the ground. So you don't want to have to take off at 150 miles an hour.
You need lift.
You need lift. But if you've got a vertical takeoff aircraft, of course, you generate a lot of lift by direct thrust, and so you can accelerate to 100 miles an hour before the wings really become necessary to lift you. And so this kind of vehicle that we have would not be able to land at an airfield at under 100 miles an hour, because it wouldn't have big enough wings to support it.
Huh.
So that gives you that ability to make the wings a lot smaller and really size them for high speed. And, of course, that's why we can go fast, and also why we have low drag, so we get good fuel economy while we're going fast.
Oh, there's an interesting... Okay, but let me stick with this for a second. The stabilization, then, obviously, as you vertically take off, is one very serious thing to try to achieve. And then stabilization as you slowly increase speed to the point where your wings are meaningful in aerodynamic flight. How do you stay stable?
Well, that, again, is conventional aerodynamics. We have the wings distributed so the vehicle is what's called inherently stable aerodynamically. It's a flying aircraft at that point. And, you know, we have wings distributed, and we, of course, have our own wind tunnel, which we've tested many thousands of hours of flight test to make sure that at least at this level that we're operating with right now, that it appears stable.
So, but the engine thrust has to be a gigantic part of that stability for the initial flight and, of course, the landing as well, right?
Exactly. It's really important. And the computers, of course, control the power in such a way that the vehicle is kept stable up until you're flying aerodynamically. But once you're flying aerodynamically, you're just like a conventional airplane. You have
sure.
Four thrusters, and you fly like an airplane.
Almost more like a jet than an airplane, as you pointed
yeah.
out. This is configured more like a jet than a conventional aircraft, certainly. So now, then you've got to have really good electronics. I mean, now, obviously, this can be held stable. I can understand how that could be done with computers. If your computer failed, what then?
Well, what you make sure you have is a highly redundant system. As you may know, many of the fighter aircraft today are absolutely unstable, even in forward flight.
Oh, yeah.
And they get away with that by having computers that keep them stable. But, of course, they have great redundancy. They have four computers in such a way that one computer can fail, the other one will take over. If that fails, another one takes over. And they've been pretty successful. They've had actually very, very few failures due to computers because of that system.
So that's exactly what you would do with this aircraft, that you'd have that much redundancy?
Absolutely. Four computers. We call it quadruple redundancy. It's an essential part of the design.
Then, would it be fair to ask you, what percentage of aircraft accidents, military aircraft accidents that do occur, are attributed to four computers failing?
We have no record of that occurring. We went on to all the sources we knew about and could find no record of that having happened. That doesn't say it didn't happen because, of course, we don't have complete access to that. But we found that the dominant failure mode was an engine failure, and then there were many other elements that caused failure, structural failures and other things. But we did not see any indication that computers played a role in any of these quadruple redundant systems. Computers have played a part in failures of aircraft in many ways, but not in this controlled area as we could determine it. We would have to make sure, of course, that is the most critically safe part of the flight because, as you say,
sure,
that's, if that fails, everything fails.
Doctor, would there be, under the worst of all conditions, or if somebody wanted to, the ability for the average person to remove computer control and control flight themselves when in those critical modes?
No, quite frankly, I think that this aircraft is, in forward flight, if you're going fast, it wouldn't matter, but you could not land this vehicle without the computer. You could not operate it under any conditions without the computer. Things just happen too fast. And it's absolutely essential. I've had one of these aircraft being flown by a superb pilot who flew it for a small period of time without the computers, but ultimately he crashed it, at least in the sense that he came back to Earth. He didn't damage anything particularly because we weren't flying very far above the ground. But he was extraordinarily talented, much more than the average person would be, perhaps even better than most pilots are.
Right, right. And he really just barely sort of handled it.
Right, barely.
So the computers would be absolutely, totally essential. And you say that you've got them pretty fortified against electromagnetic radiation and that sort of thing.
Right, because, of course, we have been flying, for those who don't know the history of our company, we have been flying with computers in our aircraft for well over 10 years now. Actually, it's about close to 15 years now.
Right.
And we've never had a computer failure while we've been in the air. We've had, as I said, an odd engine failure. But we've only, at the beginning, quite frankly, we only had one computer, so one failure was all we needed to be in trouble.
What kind of fuel would this use?
Well, it can use... one of the unique features of the Wankel-type engine is it tends to be quite fuel-insensitive in the sense that it can use or burn many different types of fuel. Right now we're flying the Skycar, the 400, with alcohol. We do that because it's a very safe fuel. You know, in the case of a fire, as we know, we use alcohol in the Indianapolis race cars because of safety. So we use alcohol, but we can run it on diesel or we can run it on gasoline.
So in an emergency, you could pour a fifth of Jim Beam in?
You could. It actually, you think that sounds like a joke, but actually it runs very well in a combination of alcohol and water. So 100 proof would be just about perfect.
Oh, really? How interesting. So that makes, at today's prices, if alcohol is viable, then it makes the cost of fuel per mile or per tank, I guess, or whatever. How do you judge it, and what is it roughly?
Well, the best you can do, and of course, the faster you go beyond a certain point, the less mileage you get. But the best condition, being flying, the best combination of altitude and speed, which is, say, 25,000 feet flying about 250 miles an hour, we can get 28 miles to the gallon.
28 miles to the gallon? Really?
Most people are going to fly faster, and they're going to probably get more like 20, just like we drive down the freeways at 80 rather than 60.
What does a 747 get per mile or per whatever?
Well, of course, we all rate that in terms of passenger miles per gallon, which is the common denominator. And we actually are a little bit better than the best of the flight vehicles today, quite a bit better than the 747. But that's in passenger miles per gallon. Of course, they carry an enormous amount of passengers.
Oh, yes.
They're very efficient in fuel. We are better than almost any vehicle out there that flies, including even some of the home-built aircraft, which are quite efficient.
Okay, so that's fuel. If you were to get into your sky car, let's take me, okay? I'm in Front Nevada, a pretty rural community. Hell, I could land that thing in a lot I have next door, right in the middle of my antenna that I just put up. And going to Las Vegas, which is a typical trip for me, 65 miles, and it's over a little mountain here, about 5,500 feet. And, of course, as a crow flies, and then as you have to drive, there are two very different things. If I could just hop over that mountain, man, I'd be in Las Vegas in just a few minutes.
15 minutes, to be precise.
15, huh?
Right.
Oh, God.
If you want to go maximum speed higher than that, but I'm giving you an efficient speed to operate at.
Uh-huh. 15 minutes. Well, wow. So I would step into this craft. I'd sit down, and if I wanted to go from here to Las Vegas, what would I have to do?
Well, right now, because there isn't a guide, there isn't a real airway in the sky yet, there will be in the next very few years, you would pilot this too. There wouldn't be much skill involved in the piloting, but you'd still have to be a pilot in the sense you have to know what other people are doing, and you have to know what the rules of the air are so you don't get in trouble in navigation and that.
All right, I'm trying to get you to imagine how it would be when it's fully commercialized. In other words, I'd step into the craft and I'd do what? What would I enter?
If it's fully commercialized, and by that you mean there's an airway network in place?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
In that case, you would just get into there, you just code in a number, 265 for Las Vegas, push a button, and you can go to sleep, you can play the computer games, you can read whatever. You're going to be delivered. You're not going to be involved in the process.
And I'm going to be there in 15 minutes.
That's correct, and it's going to land itself. It's going to take off, and it's going to land itself.
I notice you have windows. I'm looking at the front of the 400 right now, and you've got a nice window just like you would have in a sports car, say. Is that a wraparound window? Can you?
It is for the moment, but when we pressurize, which we were doing, we will have to do for a higher altitude, we'll have to break that up into sections. Right now it's one single piece, but you'll still have good visibility.
Okay, let's say, again, I'm going to Las Vegas in this vehicle. Typically, what altitude would I try? Remember, I've got a mountain there, 5,500 feet. What altitude would I attain in a trip of that duration?
Oh, you'd just go some 1,000 or two over the height of the mountain, so you wouldn't be pressurized. There's no reason to climb up for such a short flight. It really makes sense to climb up to a higher altitude because you want to go faster.
Sure.
And therefore get over a longer distance in a shorter time.
Okay, so I'd be sort of skimming treetops over the mountain there, a couple
right.
thousand feet. All right. That sounds like fun. Boy, that sounds like fun, and I'm sure this is all you've been dreaming about. Now, you mentioned higher flight to 25,000 feet. Now, obviously, at 12,000, 13,000 feet, whatever, you've got to begin to pressurize an aircraft, or everybody faints.
That's correct.
So you would do that?
Yes, that's certainly part of the plan, because it's so you can fly, you know, over 100 miles an hour faster and get the same fuel economy when you're flying at 25,000 feet versus sea level. So you're obviously going to do that if you can do it.
Well, I presume that you're saying it can be done.
It's the computer will drive you to the most, if what you want is maximum fuel economy, it would drive you to that. My guess is it's going to be something a bit faster than best fuel economy because you're on a sort of a railway track where everybody's going the same speed. And I'm presuming that people are going to want to go a bit faster than the most economic speed, but you're going to be controlled and be required to go on that particular highway at the speed that is designed into the system, which may be 300 miles an hour, it may be 250, depending on the altitude.
Okay. If you imagine it as fully commercialized, do you also imagine present-day aviation as we see it continuing? In other words, large I don't know, jet aircraft or whatever other propulsion system might come along, but the 747s and the big heavies still flying on any given day. They're coming out of Las Vegas like so many ducks in a row and headed toward places like San Francisco that would take them directly in my flight path, in my little Mueller sky car. And so how do I go to sleep safely assuming that I'm not going to connect with the 747 at 25,000 feet.
Well, it depends. You just have to have your, you have to be confident that the system itself is secure. That in today's world, it's difficult to imagine because, quite frankly, it's pretty chaotic up there. People have to look around to see if other planes are coming in their direction and often in flight. But if it's really truly computerized, if we have real-time computer capabilities so we know where every single vehicle is at all times, which is certainly going to happen, and you can think about the security advantages of that. There won't be any, you know, September 11th times dates if you can know at all times where everybody is and why they're there and who they are.
Where would this be all controlled from? In other words, would it be a function of this Mueller 400 communicating with the ground and computers on the ground that would be telling it where to go and not to go and how to go?
Right, right. It would be a major mass. They have some very sophisticated plans to be able to know at all times where, not just by GPS, but also by geostationary satellites for local control that would allow very precise, and you're talking about, in theory, in near airfields, control within centimeters. But outside of airfields or some distance away from the city, you would get down to a few feet of control and know where the person is and know who it is, too, which is critical, I'm sure, from a security point of view, to know who's up there, friend or foe.
Now, we have traffic helicopters that regularly fly over Las Vegas, and they look down on this congested, insane mess in a place called the Spaghetti Bowl. I mean, every city has this, just about every big city. And they show people, you know, tapping their fingers, waiting in long lines of stalled cars. Now, if you close your eyes and imagine all of those cars down there suddenly up in the air instead of being down there, it's almost unimaginable. I mean, would things really run?
Well, I guess what you have to consider is that when you're down on the ground, you're trying to get around in a, you could call it a two-dimensional world, if you like,
right,
with a one-dimensional transportation system,
right,
and that's doomed to failure. And all of a sudden, we give you a three-dimensional system which has multi-layers, can travel on average, quite frankly, close to 10 times faster than a car, because the cars today average about 30 miles. You know, on average, considering cities and everything else, about 30 miles an hour.
That may be optimistic in a lot of
ways. That's right. And so all of a sudden, you've got the capability going 10 times faster. So in theory, you'd need one-tenth as many. But independent of that, if all the cars that are on the ground today were in the air at the same time, they would still be miles apart, except, of course, when you get near the city where they'd have to be integrated again.
So we have that much airspace.
Tremendous amount. I mean, walk outside your house at any time and look up in the air, unless you're near a city. You're not likely to even see an airplane.
That's fairly true. You've got to sit there and wait for one. One will inevitably come by.
Oh, yes.
I mean, that is a lot of empty airspace. You make a very good point. So even fully commercialized, all those cars down on the ground in the air, there'd be at least mile separation with a greater safety factor by far than we have on our highways now when we kill 50,000 people a year?
Well, we're approaching that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going, you think about the closing speed between two cars going, you know, 70 miles an hour to two-lane highway, you got 140 miles an hour, and they go by each other 3 feet apart. I mean, we live pretty dangerously.
We do. And a lot of us die, actually. And so you think that were it all in the air, it would be actually that much safer.
Well, I always use the joke. I say that in the world that I envision, you know, even if a drunk gets on board this thing, the worst thing can happen. He can end up in the wrong city, but he's going to arrive safely.
There's a good point. All right, Doctor, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. Be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002.
Good.
Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 19, 2002.
We have got the incredible Dr. Paul Mahler on the air tonight. He's designed an air car, a personal air car to be used by people like you. And the amount of interest in it is obvious. It looks like we have, well, we've really hurt his website. And I'm sorry about that. That tells you the level of interest, though, in something like this among the general public. I mean, his website's just creeping, is definitely on its knees. You may not get on at all. And so if you don't get on tonight and you're trying to get onto his website, do it tomorrow. In the meantime, we can handle the bandwidth. And we've got at least a good photograph of the 400, the Model 400 up there. That you'll be able to see under tonight's program info, Dr. Mahler's name. Just click on that. And now if you click on his website, you're going to have to be a very, very patient person, or even perhaps wait until tomorrow, but it'll still be there for you tomorrow.
Coast to Coast AM is happy to announce that our website is now optimized for mobile device users, specifically for the iPhone and Android platforms. Now, you'll be able to connect to most of the offerings of the Coast website on your phone in a quick and streamlined fashion. And if you're a Coast insider, you'll have our great subscriber features right on your phone, including the ability to listen to live programs and stream previous shows. No special app is necessary to enjoy our new mobile site. Simply visit coasttocoastam.com on your iPhone or Android browser. Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
When you look at what's going on around this planet, it's almost as if someone has got a playbook to try to control all these countries all of a sudden. I've always said that not everything is a conspiracy, but a lot of it is.
You know, when you start looking into things, there's only a certain set of conclusions you can reach, and unfortunately, this is one of them. You know, it's very, very hard not to see things like that when you start looking at things in a larger picture.
Now we take you back to the night of September 19th, 2002, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Well, once again, here is Dr. Paul Mahler. Doctor, I'm going to take you all over the place in questions about this, if I can, a little bit. I've got all these questions by computer, and there are some pretty good ones. Link in Lakewood, Washington says, what about just taking a country drive? What about pleasure flying? Or, you know, with cars today, we don't only, even though it seems that way sometimes, use them to get back and forth to work in traffic jams. Sometimes we just go out and drive to have a hell of a good time, to get out and let your hair down a little bit and have fun and look at the scenery. Well, gee whiz, your vehicle, it seems to me, would offer that times 10 if it would allow for that sort of thing. In other words, just not utilitarian flight, but fun flight. And so the question is, would your vehicle allow for that?
Well, it would be there'd be a prescribed airway system that when you're on, you have to follow the exact rules, clearly for the safety of everybody.
Sure.
But there certainly would be, I wouldn't call them off-road recreational parks, but they're off-air, whatever, where you could certainly fly around under some prescribed conditions. But keeping in mind that, you know, this is a small vehicle, and two of these vehicles going at 300 miles an hour in opposite directions is pretty risky. So, you know, you'd have to do it in a manner in which there was a lot of control just the same, whether it was precise in terms of being exactly the same speed as everybody else. Certainly you're going to have a lot of supervision, electronic supervision, to make it safe.
Yeah, but I guess I'm asking if the electronic supervision would allow for that. For example, we have national parks all over the country, and a lot of them are really beautiful and wondrous to fly over. For example, the Grand Canyon and other areas that I could think about would be just wondrous to just for fun, if it were allowed under such a system, to fly over. I mean, national parks, why not have them visited by air as well as we now have it?
Sure.
Driving.
That's quite possible, since obviously the system's going to be better than it is today, and we do have aircraft flying around, light planes flying around right now that can go 300 miles an hour. So, yes, we could. This would be possible, and with the added security that we're going to provide, you're going to know if there's other people in your area. You're going to have a onboard sensors that'll tell you that there's somebody to your left or to your right, in addition to a lot of input from a central control network. But yes, you'll have that degree of freedom outside of the controlled airway network.
Boy, that sounds great. Somebody from Hawaii, Gary in Hawaii, says, ask them how loud the craft will be. How loud is it now, and how loud do you imagine it to be if it were a production commercial version?
Well, right now it's fairly loud because the nature of where we've concentrated our technology is on, you know, powering it up and the stability system and other things.
Of course.
But we're working very hard on what's called mutual noise cancellation technology, and that's when you generate what's called an anti-noise. You generate the same frequencies and then you phase shift it. It sounds pretty technical, but really what you're doing is generating a noise in opposition to the existing noise and moving it out of phase so it cancels the present noise. That is really the future of this, because there's nothing short of that that's going to allow you to land at your home or even in a city center. And we are, that's the next area of major research activity. And of course, you know, now that we're a public company, we have, you know, everybody is really in a position to become part of our company, something that hasn't happened in the past. And of course,
I mean, you actually issue shares now, and people can buy shares?
People can go to their broker and become part of our company.
Well, now that's new.
It's very new. It's very new. It's very exciting because it gives everybody a chance to participate in this to a small degree. In the past, quite frankly, and I always resented this. The only people who could invest in us were very, very rich people who could afford to lose it. Now that we've got this public offering, people can come out here and put modest amounts of money into our company and become a participant in it.
Oh, that's a big jump. When companies are very small, it's like you've got to be a millionaire to even be allowed to invest at that level because it's so risky.
Yeah, it's not necessarily always risky, but, you know, the control people within the government have a very paternal view of these things. They're going to protect you at all costs. And sometimes some very exciting technologies never see the light of day because they never get the opportunity to raise the kind of capital they need. We were being fortunate over the years that we've had what we call angel investors, people who have quite a large amount of money, perhaps, but they believe in what we're doing. They're patient. They've stuck with us.
These would be the same people that saved us recently from WorldCom, right?
This is the kind of person who you really want on board, because he doesn't come in like a greedy venture capitalist might, or he certainly is not an institution which wouldn't invest in our kind of technology anyhow. They're people who have a futuristic view of what can happen, and they're willing to support it.
So in other words, now you're an over-the-counter traded stock, pink slip type or whatever?
Well, we're pink slip for the next couple of weeks, and then we'll be bulletin board. But we do qualify for NASDAQ. I mean, it's just a matter of there's a certain time that you have to...
Boy, that's exciting. That's really exciting.
We'll be out there, and we have already a fairly active market in our stock, despite the fact that it's on the pink sheets, which makes it harder to get a hold of.
Yeah, but not impossible, and then eventually NASDAQ. That's really exciting.
Anybody that just takes our symbol, MLER, and goes to the broker can buy stock.
MLER?
Correct.
That's your symbol, okay. All right, well, you know, I tried to press you to come on the air about 2-3 times since last time I had you on the air. And you always said, no, we want to wait, we've got some testing to do, and we want to have something to tell you when we come on the air, right?
That was exactly my response.
Yeah.
And, of course, when we flew the Sky Car in July of this year for the first time, the 400, that made things very different. And now that we're a public company, meaning that people who believe or would like to be a participant in this can become part of our company, that's also a very big change.
Take me back to July. I mean, what happened in July? Tell me exactly what happened and what you did.
Well, we have people who are already invested in our company have, in many cases, possessed options to buy additional stock. But
right.
One of the conditions was that after we did a demonstration flight, they would have to exercise that option. In other words, go ahead and buy the stock within 90 days or they would lose it.
Sure.
Well, we did that flight. It was a flight of 1 minute in a very controlled manner out of ground effect. And that was the demonstration we did. We typically don't fly very long because we don't use a very large amount of fuel on board because of the danger during these test flights. So
okay.
A 1 minute flight hovering in conditions that sometimes were very windy was quite an accomplishment for us. And that started the ball rolling and allowed us to raise a good deal of capital from these options that have to be exercised.
Well, exactly what did you do? I mean, you say you spent 1 minute hovering.
Well, we took off from the ground, of course, and rose to about 20 feet. By the way, that flight can be seen on our Internet site.
As I just explained to you, Doctor, I don't know whether you've tried to access your site here in the last little while.
No, we knew it would be tough, actually. We put on a bunch of additional sites tonight to help this because we've had, we've had as many as a couple hundred thousand hits a day even in the past.
Yeah.
So we know with this show we'll probably see a lot more.
Yeah, it's crippling right now. But, people should be patient. In the next day or two, it'll lighten up and you'll be able to get in. So you're saying you've got video.
There's video on our website showing the Skycar flying.
Wow. Since everybody doesn't have a computer, and since not everybody's going to be able to see this, lucky few will, describe in words what you see in the video.
Well, this vehicle is about the size of an automobile, 8.5 feet wide, about 19 feet long. So it's, it's a larger size car, but it still would fit in a single car garage.
Right.
It carries four passengers, as I said. It has a bubble canopy. It has four lifting, what we call nacelles, one at each corner of the vehicle. And in each nacelle, there are two engines driving independent fans. These are the devices that generate the thrust or the lift of the air. This air is then deflected as it leaves the duct downwards or backwards, depending on whether you're hovering or going forward. So it takes off like a helicopter with the air being deflected downwards, and then what we call transitions to aerodynamic flight, where the air is then deflected progressively further and further backwards until it becomes, as you said earlier, a bit like a jet airplane.
Our military has a version of a vertical takeoff plane that I think we fly. It's a British thing, isn't it? What's it called?
The Hawker Harrier jump jet.
Yeah, the Harrier jump jet. Now, they've had some, pretty recent terrible disasters with the Harrier. And I wonder if you could reflect for me on what you know about that and why you think they're having trouble with the Harrier.
Well, the Harrier, like any vertical takeoff aircraft, is obviously very dependent on something going wrong with a power plant, and that has a single engine. So if that engine skips a beat, that aircraft is on the ground in a heap.
It's a rock.
It's absolutely a rock. In fact, that's a very, if you think about that aircraft, it weighs about 20,000 pounds, but it has 40,000 horsepower.
Wow.
So it barely has enough as a result of the weight of that engine, and just barely enough to take off vertically. It normally actually does a jump. It goes down a short runway, hits a ski ramp, so to speak, and jumps into the air, and then it comes back after it's used up its fuel and can land vertically. It's a very clever aircraft. We got to give a lot of credit to what they achieved with that, but it still uses one engine, and that's not the kind of vehicle I want to get in when I'm hovering over some very hard surface below me.
Sure. So you don't see any relationship to what your Skycar ultimately will be with respect to the problems of the Harrier? It's all a matter of how many engines you've got. One engine, and
we have the ability to have an engine fail, and you can assume, in all fairness, that if you own a vehicle like this over a significant period of time, you're likely to have a bird go into the fan. There's a number of things that could happen that would be unforeseen, even though our engines are probably the most reliable engine you could possibly have. It's still going to happen, and the beauty of the system is that you can then continue to hover, or you can deploy the parachutes in some very catastrophic situation, because we have parachutes that bring the vehicle down.
What a good idea.
In case that should happen.
Parachutes. What a really good idea. And they would support the aircraft in the worst-case scenario?
Right. They would bring it down. Now, you damage the aircraft somewhat because it's hard to make an aircraft land so softly with parachutes, but you would survive without being hurt, and
that's the
critical part.
Yeah, everything else, insurance, right?
Right.
So it would take you to the ground with a bumpy ride, perhaps, but you'd live.
You would live and you wouldn't be injured. We know that. You would just have a kind of a crunched bottom side of the vehicle.
Ah, insurance. All right, so that's great. Where do you go from here? I mean, now all of a sudden, all right, you're becoming a public company. You're going to have the financing you need. What's the next step?
Well, we know that we're going to be building military vehicles. We've had a lot of interest in the military. One of the problems that we've always had in our business is generating the kind of capital that's required to build a number of vehicles so that if something goes wrong,
yes,
it wouldn't be catastrophic for the company.
Oh, but Doctor, you're not going to let the military take this away from us, are you?
Oh, no. No, that one of the beauties of what we have done is that we have never accepted or solicited a military contract for the Sky Car. So we have developed this entirely with our own capital, or I would say the capital of some very considered people in the United States. And so we have complete freedom to take this purely into the civilian area. But there's always some advantage in building it for the military initially because it can happen quicker.
Yeah.
They can test it. They got good pilots. And, of course, it's good for the country.
Yeah. I suppose. It's just that great fear.
I know exactly. I mean, I've always been very, very careful about this and gone out of my way not to. I've accepted money for unmanned versions of this for military and civilian applications, but I've never got a dollar for the Sky Car or ever tried to get a dollar for the Sky Car from the military. But you can always sell the hardware. That's very different. You know, build vehicles, sell them to the civilian market, and also make them available for people who want to buy them for the military.
All right, well, you know,
that's a little different.
Yeah, okay, fine. Let's discuss, for that reason, what the military application would be. I mean, what do you see our military using something like this for?
Well, you know, the military, interesting enough, and I'll speak specifically about the Army right now, has this vision that in the future what they would like to do is break gravity. They have a term called breaking gravity. They want to see an airborne army. And I don't mean by that necessarily so much of the fighting component, but say the medevac component, the logistics component, where they can bring a payload, about 4x4x5 foot payload to the front lines when it's needed in an emergency. And the Sky Car is that vehicle. In fact, they've even given it a name within the military called a LAMV, L-A-M-V, standing for Light Airborne Multipurpose Vehicle. It's
yeah, that sounds
very promising
military
for them.
Yeah, that really sounds, that's got the military ring to it. Who gave it that moniker, do you know?
A very decent supporter, Colonel Harmon, within the battlefield of the future. He's been an ardent supporter of ours, but of course, you know, there's a tremendous amount of resistance within the helicopter community, within the military forces. They have a vested interest in things with big rotors on top, and they're not about to give that up easily, I can guarantee you.
So there are large forces potentially aligned against you in the military. The military is a very political thing, isn't it?
It seems that way. It's like a two-handled thing because I've had this very great support from someone like Colonel Harmon, who's written very supportive articles in military journals about this, and then I've had individuals, which I won't name, who have clearly done everything they can. Surprisingly, not dissimilar to what they did to undermine the Wright brothers. The military was a very antagonistic entity with regard to the efforts of the Wright brothers. It is something where something new comes along like that, and if it's not government-generated, they're very antagonistic towards it.
Well, if you make Blackhawks, and you've got billions of dollars invested in Blackhawks or whatever the latest is, you might be concerned about what Dr. Mueller's doing, right?
Some might. I say there's a good contingent in there that have been highly supportive of us, and I have to give them credit.
But whether or not the military decides to become involved with this, you can develop and deploy the Sky Car, right?
Absolutely, and we will. I mean, that's an adjunct to what we're doing. It's an exciting way to underwrite some of the costs, but I believe that our support, because of what we've seen already from outside interest, will be high enough that we will be able to fund this project.
Either way. All right. Doctor, hold on.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 19, 2002. Networks presents Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired September 19, 2002.
Obviously, a lot of you dream of this kind of flight, as do I, Dr. Mahler, and others. Well, here it is, folks. We've got it for you. Take a look and get to our picture, at least, on the website. His website's kind of jammed up right now, but you'll get to it in the next day or so. It's all about a personal flying vehicle. I wonder if it's going to be available, in Dr. Mahler's opinion, in our lifetime? That seems like a really good question. We'll ask it in a moment.
We take you back to the night of September 19th, 2002, on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Once again, here is Dr. Paul Mahler. And, Doctor, it's a pretty good question. If everything went reasonably smoothly with investment and production and politics and regulation and all the rest of it, if everything went fairly smoothly, when could we possibly expect to see people starting to get into these and flying?
Well, it's a limited number because the cost will be high when the volume is initially not large. As little as 3 years. That's sort of the maximum length that we would expect FAA certification to take. Building the aircraft is not a problem. Building fairly large numbers of the aircraft is not a problem, but you have to pass FAA's certification.
Yeah, but 3 years.
But it would still be a fairly expensive machine because, of course, the volume would not be there at that time.
Do you imagine that you would have to take a test and qualify as you do to drive a car right now to use an air car?
Well, there is, interesting enough, there's already a pilot's license for it. The FAA has already a pilot's license in place called a powered lift pilot's license. So they're anticipating it happening. I think the best number I can give you is the one put forward by the head of NASA, Dr. Daniel Golden, who said that he felt that these vehicles would be in the hands of 25% of the American population within 10 years and 90% of the population within 25.
Holy mackerel. That's our lifetimes, all right, I hope. Tom in Orlando, Florida asks a really good question. What is the range presently of this vehicle without having to refuel?
900 miles.
900 miles.
900 miles, which is interesting enough. You asked an earlier question, you know, would the big airplanes still be around? They would, but they would be flying the long distances because 80% of the flights today are less than 900 miles. So we could get rid of 80% of those flights, and then all of a sudden you could get to an airport and actually get on an airplane.
Well, hey, the way things are going for commercial airlines right now, you'll be lucky if there are any more of them flying in the skies by the time you get the air car
up. That's true, too.
Do you plan to make, or has anybody even envisioned, Doctor, this is from Alberta, Canada, something bigger, you know, like a bus version of the sky car? I mean, if you can have a sky car, can you have a sky bus?
No, you can't. It's interesting.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, the laws of physics are interesting. You can't avoid them. This is not magic. This is real physical laws.
And right.
It turns out that you can get as big as 6 passengers, which is really stretching it. The only reason I'm going that direction is because there's a real interest in carrying a 1,500-pound payload. So you can go to 6 passengers. Then you have to go to, like, the V-22 Osprey, the one with the large rotating propellers that
right.
had some bad publicity from crashes.
Right.
That's the next appropriate design. And it's sensibly thought out. It just turns out to be a terribly expensive machine that's had its share of problems.
All right. Well, what about this? The environmentalists out there, who are already going wacko over everything we're doing, driving around and all the rest of it, they're going to go totally berserk. Even if it's not justified, the environmentalists are going to go berserk, and they're going to say, we're going to destroy the entire world with this. Right?
There will be a certain amount that will. I think we can make some of them happy, and the way we can do that is because our emissions level with our engine operating in the conditions is so low that at least that part of our operation can be defended. You know, there's certainly going to be people that don't want something flying over their heads, but I'm afraid that they're going to have to live with it.
So you think you'd be able to make a pretty good case for the environmentalist versus the present automobile setup that we've got right now?
Right, because the automobile today, interesting enough, and not a lot of people know that, about 90% of the emissions, actually over 90% of the emissions, occur in slow traffic or stopped in traffic. The automobile is actually pretty efficient, the modern car going down the highway at, you know, 60, 70 miles an hour. But it's terribly inefficient, as a sky car would be if it was idling. But there's no such a thing as idling with a sky car. You're either flying very fast or you're stopped and the engine's no longer running when you land on the ground. So we have a situation where the engine is a very low pollutant device in the first place, plus it's operated much more efficiently.
All right. Miles in Lubbock, Texas, pretty good question. Miles says, hey, it's daylight. I want to check my cattle. Can I fly around the ranch at 15 or 20 miles an hour forward speed or cruise over the hill to the next ranch at 80 to 100 miles away for a coffee or whatever?
Absolutely. Yeah, no problem at all.
Really?
You fly over your own ranch. Once this thing is certified, you own it, you're free to do anything you want within your airspace over your ranch. Actually, you have some limitation if you go above 500 feet. But 500 feet down, that's your airspace. You still have to have FAA certification to fly in it, but you can do what you want.
Would there be any application, there's a lot of development underway right now with fuel cells, you know, Ballard up in Canada, and a lot of people are talking about fuel cells as a fuel of the future and all the rest of that, hydrogen, actually. Would that be one possible fuel that's being considered for the
Well, hydrogen has been used in the rotary engine by Mazda, and it is being used extensively by BMW in Europe right now, so I think hydrogen is a good choice. The problem really is storage. It is very efficient per pound, but of course it is very light per pound too.
Right.
So it's a trade-off issue. I think it's something that's probably at least 10 years away, as I think the fuel cell is for automobiles.
About 10 years.
Right. Both those would probably come about because I think fuel cells will drive the cost of hydrogen down. It'll generate technologies for generating hydrogen, and hydrogen has some advantages, but. I think they're at least 10 years away.
Okay. How about the political aspects of this? Now you got Ford and GM and, you know, really big money producing these cars that go along the ground. Now, how are they going to react to Dr. Mueller and your company producing something that's going to go zipping through the air and make that look like a horse and buggy?
Well, I have to be, you know, I have to be honest. There's no way that I'm going to control this technology as far as manufacturing. I mean, I'm going to have to license it. If this is going to be a major item in transportation, I'm going to have to join forces with a BMW or a Ford or some good manufacturing company. And I don't mind that. I mean, it makes sense to do so. I've already I've already made a presentation to Ford, and I've had both Honda and BMW visit me.
Oh, really? So, most people in your position, or a lot anyway, over history, have tried to fight them. So instead of fighting them, you're going to join them.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a technologist. I really enjoy creating. And I have, of course, manufactured products in the past. People who are familiar with the Supertramp muffler, which is fairly well known, was a product that I developed and we manufactured in large numbers. But when it comes to something this big, and if it's really going to have universal use, it's going to be produced by a number of companies, and that would be very satisfying.
When we talk about the military, there's another aspect of the U.S. government that it seems to me there would be application for. For example, a GM in Lake Havasu City, Arizona says, what do you think of the Sky Car? How about being used for applications like the Border Patrol?
Oh, yes. Paramilitary applications are really big, and they're ideal because, you know, one of the problems with sort of drug interdiction today is that you've got airplanes that go fast, but they can't land vertically, and you've got helicopters that can land vertically, but they can't go fast. And so trying to catch these guys can be extremely difficult because they'll dump their plane into the jungle, you know, wipe out the plane, but survive and run off with the drugs. A vehicle like this would make it very difficult since it can fly almost as fast as a jet airplane, can land vertically. I think it would be extremely difficult for the drug people to get away with when the paramilitary groups have this.
On the other hand, the drug guys would have it too.
Well, I mean,
there are
ways to control that, of course. In the world that I've described, where we have a completely electronically integrated control network, we're going to know everybody who's up there. I mean, that's one element where security of, you know, personal security of people worrying about knowing who they are and where they are is going to go away. We're going to know where everybody is and who they are up there at all times. So it's going to be part of a changing world, not just because of the Sky Car, but because that's the way we're going.
Doctor, isn't this likely to totally destroy these speed trap towns?
I suppose so.
Somebody asks about diesel as a fuel. Diesel, of course, is a very interesting fuel in many, many ways. It's used by truckers to get so much across the nation, and the average person doesn't realize the advantages of a diesel engine versus a piston engine. So what about diesel as a fuel?
Yeah, we've been running on diesel fuel in our engine.
Oh, really?
And one of the advantages of diesel, of course, is that it is, in some countries, a very inexpensive fuel compared to all the alternatives, places like India, for example. Plus, it's a fuel that has what I like about it is the safety. It's much less likely to catch fire, even though it burns just as rapidly when it does. So we have actually been running this. In fact, we've been running it on a combination of diesel and water and gasoline and water and alcohol and water. Believe it or not, when you mix these two together, you get a very fire-resistant fuel that still burns very well in our engine. There's no magic about it. We're not getting power out of the water. The water just serves as a factor in the emissions and in also the safety that go with the combination.
This is so incredible. I mean, and you're talking about 3 years. We might see this thing in some sort of limited public application in 3 years. How much of an uphill battle do you have to fight with, you know, I don't know, the FAA, whoever certifies this sort of thing before it can fly? How much of an uphill battle?
Well, they have been pretty cooperative so far. We've played a part in writing the rules, certification rules, because of course, really, there is nobody else out there that's building this kind of vehicle. So when it comes to a civilian version of what's called a power lift aircraft, they've had a look to us to give them some feel for what is going to be necessary. But it's a bureaucratic organization, so you're going to face that typical problem. Hopefully, if you have enough funds, you can certainly speed that process up, because it you don't exactly bribe them, but you certainly help the process if you can provide a lot of capital along the road.
That's such a, it's such a radical departure that it virtually is kind of like going from the horse and buggy to the powered car. I mean, it's that big of a jump, isn't it?
It will be, because it'll do so much to change the demographics of how we live. If you can make a 60-mile commute in 15 minutes, you're going to see people moving out of the cities who now live there just because of the inconvenience of getting in and out of that city.
Ah, so in other words, it's going to redistribute the population.
It'll change real estate values pretty significantly. I would want to be one of the first people selling my apartment in San Francisco if I could, before everybody else moved out.
Because that's just what they do.
Absolutely.
And there is so much. When you fly across America, you are shocked at how much unused land there is. I mean, you think we're all packed together, and we are, of course, in the cities. But when you look at what could be done, most of America is empty.
It's empty because of limited access, difficult to get to, and that could change enormously.
SkyCar would change that right away, wouldn't it?
It would change it very rapidly. I think it's an important factor in the future of the way we live, that kind of transportation. Again, in all fairness, I'm not saying the SkyCar is going to be the only version. I think the technology we have is going to be a part of everything that is developed in the future, but this is going to be an evolving technology. We've shown that the vehicle can be practical.
What do you have for competition now, Doctor? What else is out there? I mean, is there anybody breathing down your corporate neck?
No. Interesting enough, there's two sides of that coin, of course. One is that, big companies or major investment groups are not willing to participate because they don't see the future of this technology. On the other hand, I'm left alone, and I'm able to generate large numbers of patents without anybody competing with me. So I have, I have some major benefits from being left alone for the moment. So I feel comfortable with where we are, particularly with where we now have become with the being a public company and being able to raise capital in a much more open manner. This is a big change for us, and it's very exciting for the future of the SkyCar.
The whole thing is exciting. So exciting. Have you maintained, you're right there every day. So I don't know if you maintain the same level of excitement about this that you once did. I suppose it's become a down hard business for you now, but it's still that the excitement that people feel right now hearing about this. Does that stay with you?
It's terribly exciting. I mean, I really, most days I can't wait to get to work, because we always have some going on, whether it's finding ways to eliminate noise, whether it's ways to increase the efficiency of the engine or reduce the emissions, or demonstrate some new component of the improving technology. Every day is exciting, and it's certainly the most exciting time of the development now that we have the opportunity to build a number of these rather than just a few demonstrators.
You're going to be at the Texas State Fair, it says, in Dallas, Texas, September 27th through October 20th. What does that mean? Does that mean you're taking the SkyCar?
We're taking a non-flying mock-up, but it's pretty complete in every way. It shows the vehicle, and you get a real sense for it in terms of appearance, and you can sit in it. Theoretically, it has all electronics on board.
Really?
And it's been all over the world. We've had it in Malaysia. We've had it in Abu Dhabi. It's been in Amsterdam. It's been at the Paris Air Show. It's been at the Paris Show in Farnborough in England. It's been a good source of information for people who've come to various shows around the world to see it.
And then early next year, I hear you're going to have a demonstration of the first production, the M400 model, designed possibly for military sales. Is that right?
Well, the model we'll demonstrate will be a civilian model, certainly, at that stage.
But, I mean, you're going to do a full-scale demo?
Right. We're going to...
Wow.
Right now, I'm reluctant to fly the vehicle because I don't, really push it, because I only have one of them. And if something were to go wrong, it would be it would be very difficult for our test program.
How confident, as a matter of curiosity, are you that if you decided to risk it and fly the vehicle, it would fly well?
Well, I'd like to get away from the ground as far as possible at the beginning and rely upon aerodynamic flight
right.
and the parachutes if something went wrong, because, of course, the most dangerous region is that region near the ground. We do have the parachutes, but they do take some time to open.
Oh, sure.
Unless you're going forward, of course. Actually, you don't have to be going that fast, even 25 miles an hour, and the parachutes will open very quickly. But hovering is risky when you're just starting out, because even though this is a simple machine in many ways, there's still a lot of computer software on board, and we all know about computer software.
Oh, yes, we do. But still, the question hangs. If you had to do it, are you fairly confident that the Sky Car would fly?
Oh, we know it'll fly, and we feel very comfortable it'll fly safely, even with a fader, which is the critical part of this device. We've set it up so that there's no single component in this vehicle that could fail that would bring down the entire aircraft. Whereas if you think of a helicopter today, and you've seen the number of parts that are going around
yes.
and that thing, you can lose one nut or one bolt in a number of places in that vehicle, and you've lost the vehicle.
Yeah, I know we've had recent tragedies here. Doctor, have you considered the implications of increasing the roles of the Mile High Club so far as to make the whole thing meaningless? Hold on, we're at the top of the hour. When we come back, we'll take phone calls for Dr. Paul Muller. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002.
Know that you have, 'cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles. If you think that I don't know about the little tricks you play, and never see you when deliberately you put them in my way.
10 children that have autism.
In my life, and you know that I should. Just bring her along, just all right. If I could and I would. But what can I do? I'll roll it too. And it makes me feel, it makes me know. Just tonight, I'm in way.
Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002.
I mean, after all, how's the backseat of a 57 Chevrolet differ all that much from the backseat of a 2007 Mueller Sky Car? The only difference would be altitude, right? Dr. Paul Muller is here, developer of the Sky Car that you can see on the web. It's incredible. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. And it's coming within, say, 3 or 4 years. It's coming, folks. It's a reality. So we're not talking about science fiction here. We're talking about fact that's about to be in production.
Weird stories on the radio? Must be Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, when I started doing this radio program, Jesse, half of the subjects I was really into, the paranormal, the unusual, ghosts and things like that.
Yeah.
The conspiracy stories, you know, I was a little weary about these, other than the Kennedy assassination. And all of a sudden, I woke up. I simply woke up. Is that what happened with you too?
Yeah, that's when I really started to say, what is going on here? And I started to truly then investigate 9/11. And today, I don't believe the government story of 9/11. Here's the three options. Either we knew about it and allowed it to happen, or we knew about it and participated in it, or these were the dumbest buffoons that could have ever been in charge of our country, who could have all this pre-information. And I started to think they knew it was going to happen. They either are part of it or they allowed it to. There's no doubt in my mind.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002.
What I've asked a lot of what I can think of to ask, pretty much, and so I'm going to turn Dr. Mahler over to you for the balance of the program, let you ask questions, whatever you'd like to ask about this incredible thing that's coming. It's really coming. In fact, it exists now and will be available for first military use 3 years maybe, and then, you know, within not too many more to all of us. Try and imagine that in your head. For all of us, a frequent problem, doctor, with commercial aircraft is when they ingest some kind of bird or something into an engine, and it's big trouble. I mean, geese or whatever, and something flies into the engine, a bird, and down you go. What about the Mueller Sky Car? Again, I guess you would tell us you're going to lose an engine and keep going.
Right. We will have. We don't presently have it, but we will have a very large cell, what they call stainless steel honeycomb across the leading of the duct, so that if something like that were to come along, it would sort of sift it into smaller pieces before it gets the first fan. But even if it took out the first fan, we have a backup of the second fan. And we've had, accidentally, I could like to say we did it on purpose, but we've sucked in some pretty nasty objects into the fan.
Oh, really?
I think the worst thing we sucked in was a huge roll of duct tape, and if you know anything about duct tape, you can imagine that's a pretty nasty thing to go into a fan.
Definitely bad.
It did cut it up into nice little pieces and set it on through, and we recently had a screwdriver go into the fan.
Oh, my God.
It took a nick out of the fan, but didn't do any unbalance problems or anything. So, you know, indirectly in accidents over these many years that we've been testing our ductive fans, we've had a certain number of those kinds of things occur without any dire consequences.
That's remarkable. Would we see, like, FedEx Sky Cars, you think? I
think that would be an excellent example, ability to deal with, you know, you can imagine what that would do for local delivery.
Oh, boy.
And so we think this is a very good commercial application for it early on, and the more vehicles we can build for whatever application, the cheaper they come and the more likely we can all afford to own them.
Boy, it sure would make that pizza guy's job easier, the one who's got to get there in 30 minutes or less or something.
That's true. It would change a few things.
Yeah. Well, for example, I wonder what kind of operating system. We've got Microsoft, right? And they've got something called the blue screen of death. Now, it would take on a new meaning in the air.
Well, I'm not familiar with that term, but I'm familiar enough with Microsoft that I'd choose to avoid it if I possibly could, because we've had a lot of, in our own applications, whenever we've used Microsoft, which we do quite often just because it has such a great database.
Oh, you must have seen that. When something goes wrong, you get that blue screen where you got to reboot completely. I mean, it's just
rebooting is a very common thing with Microsoft.
That's what I mean.
The terminology, I'm not a very good...
It's slang. It's not, you know, Microsoft would never say that, of course, blue screen of death. They don't call it that. They call it the blue screen of instruction.
Right.
But it's essentially the blue screen of death. And in a Sky Car, it would be...
Yeah, we use machine language and C language and various languages, and we write our own programs. And of course, when you do a redundant system, say you have four computers, you have a completely separate group of people writing each one of those programs.
So again, to answer the question, you'd have your own operating system.
We do. And we make sure that each computer has a different set of programmers. So if there's a mistake made that you can't catch or you won't see until later in life, hopefully, then it would be backed up into another computer, which is written by a different person.
You know, I was not aware of this, but I'm told by one of my computer folks here that you are a big fan of Edgar Cayce's. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Then can we ask you, Edgar Cayce, did he ever mention any details that you're aware of about the Atlantean Sky vehicles? There was something about that, wasn't there?
Oh, yes. Yes, there was a definite reference to vehicles of some sort that were powered by some ground microwave. Again, you're trying to interpret things that don't translate very well because they're expressed in terminology that's a little biblical in many ways. But there was certainly many references to the fact that there were airborne vehicles if in fact Atlantis was a reality, and certainly Cayce seems to believe through what his information source that it did exist.
So this would be like part of Atlantis Rising, wouldn't it?
It could be. It's an interesting thought.
All right, let's go to the phone and see what's out there. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Paul Moeller. Hi.
Hello. I've enjoyed every minute of the show tonight.
Thank you.
My question is, does the doctor think that this is going to be truly successful without total human control? Because I'm having a hard time believing that.
Okay.
Without human control, you're wondering if it could be successful?
Yeah, well, actually, let's try that question this way. Right now, I don't drive it all that frequently, but I've got a Firebird Trans Am out there. I love that thing. And every now and then, not that I would ever exceed the speed limit, but I do go out in the country here where I live. We have desert here, and I go fast sometimes. Just for fun. And I operate the vehicle. Now, his question is a pretty good one when you think about it. In other words, if you take the actual handling and operation of the vehicle and the thrill of the drive, the thrill of the control, if you take that away, will it be accepted by the general public? That's a pretty good question.
Well, I think that, like any new system, it's going to have to prove itself. Going to have to be out there and establish a level of safety. That's one of the reasons, quite frankly, that we think a good way to introduce this is to the military. Not because we love the military particularly, but because it will have a chance to be sort of what they call electronics burned in. There will be a chance for you to find out if there's things that are wrong with it. But in that mode, if your life is caught up in traffic, you're going to have a sky car for the practicality of it. You may also want it as a sports vehicle and use it the way you describe, which is perfectly acceptable. But in terms of mass transportation, if that's going to be what this vehicle serves its purpose as, it's going to be something that everybody's going to, they're going to want it as badly as people wanted a television set when they...
I'll bet. And maybe worse. Of course, now, again, though, in a car, if you're even halfway cool, you have a standard transmission, not an automatic stupid dummy transmission, and you enjoy switching gears and feeling the power when you tromp it to the floor and all of that stuff. Now, that's pretty much gone with a sky car.
Well, you can fly this vehicle just like you fly an airplane. You can do loops and rolls and any of those things.
Oh.
Just don't do them within the controlled airspace, so to speak.
Oh.
Yeah, nothing. This vehicle, when I fly it, I have a stick on my left hand which controls the rate of climb and the altitude I'm after, and my right hand controls a stick that says you push it forward, you go forward, you pull it backwards, you put the brakes on, and you stop on a dime, and you twist it sideways or roll it sideways, you go sideways, you twist it, and you turn. So it's two sticks, one in each hand, and that's your total control technology. Now, that, of course, is taken out of your hands when it's moved into a control network. But it's there and available to you early on, and if you want to have that and fly outside of a given airspace where these systems are unlocked, when you're in the airspace, they won't do anything for you. Outside the airspace, they'll be unlocked, and you can do what you want.
And so the thrill of driving can still be the thrill of driving times 10 when you're flying, right?
Absolutely.
Right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dr. Paul Moeller. Hi.
Hey, Art and Mr. Moeller. How are you all this evening?
Fine, sir.
Very good, thanks.
I'm in Indiana. This is Chuck. I'm listening to you on XM. And, Art, one thing for you, George and Barbara did a great job, and it's great to have the master back.
Thank you. What's up, sir? Do you have a question?
Yes. On this license for the car, is it going to be something akin to maybe a multi-engine aircraft, or is it going to be something that's much simpler, something more attainable for the average person?
All right, this is a very, very good question. We should come back to this. He's asking about licensing. You know, what you'll have to go through to operate this vehicle. And you said there's already a license that exists.
There's already a powered lift pilot's license, and there is no skill required to fly this vehicle. What is required is your knowledge of the what they call ground school. What do you have to do? What are the rules of the air? What do you have to watch out for? Because the vehicle itself is like giving you onboard lessons at all times. It does what you want it to do, but it does it in a controlled manner inherent in the design. So it'll be very easy to fly, and as I said earlier, I've been the test pilot for the last 30 years. I've never had a pilot's license. It's very easy to fly. I've never felt that I was in danger flying this vehicle.
But directly answer the question, the license that would be involved, you envision, would be something that would be in the grasp of the average...
It would be simpler than a driver's license.
Oh,
put it that
really?
Way.
Really?
Yes, it's definitely...
Well, damn, they give those to almost anybody.
That's true. I don't think that's necessarily what they should be doing, but that
plus
is true.
Different show.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. So that's simple. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Mueller. Hi.
Hi, this is Travis from Richmond, Kentucky. Thank you, Art, for having me on.
Sure.
And Dr. Mueller, I'm very excited to get a chance to ask you this question. Probably 15, 20 years ago, a friend, I think maybe a CB club, held out this as a dream. And I think he knew of some development about this Sky Car. I'm totally blind. And he said, you know, if you had the money, just think you could get one of these things and go by yourself anywhere you want. You know, basically, is that what this is?
That is exactly what is possible with this. Absolutely. You wouldn't be using it as a recreational vehicle because you would be using it as a really good way of getting from point A to point B.
Which he has a tough time doing now without help.
Right.
So you're telling me somebody, a sightless person, could hop in, push the right buttons with audio, no doubt, assistance, and simply go from point A to point B, Chicago to L.A., whatever.
Absolutely. This is a fact. And it's, I mean, a five-year-old theoretically could fly this thing because the only damage you could do is get himself to the wrong point. But it you're coding in a number. Computers are taking you where you want to go.
Trust me, five-year-olds will be in the air.
Probably.
Well, at least they'll be safe, right?
They'll be safe.
They just might be away from home for a while. Now, Joshua in Fort Lauderdale asks, what about fueling? In other words, could you or would you or would the vehicle be programmed to know where fuel is and when in need, go and seek it out and stop if you were on a long trip?
Yeah, that would all be programmed ahead of time. Since it's a 900-mile trip, if you were coding in a number that was more than the 900-mile range, it would automatically land at some point and be refueled along the line. That would not be difficult to add to the system. The system is pretty intelligent because it is a digital system with a lot of programming power, so you could pretty much ask it to do almost anything, and it would be capable of doing it.
All right. We've come a little ways with regard to service of automobiles. I mean, it used to be that you had to have a tune-up pretty quick. I mean, a few thousand miles, you had to have a tune-up. Now I think you can go, like a lot of cars, 100,000 miles before you even get a tune-up. What would the service, what kind of service would be mandatory with these engines as you now know about it, as you think it will be commercially? What would service be like?
Well, we would do what's called monitored maintenance, in the sense that you have on board a lot of vibration sensors, oil contamination sensors, fuel contamination sensors, so you have a lot of onboard monitoring, even as we have it now. The maintenance will be, we don't know, of course, the total length of time because we haven't had enough experience, but we know it's something in excess of a couple thousand hours. It appears from our tests that the engine has the capability of running well over 10,000 hours, which, of course, at, you know, 300 miles an hour is 3 million miles.
So you would have the equivalent of check engine soon, you know, that light, right?
Checking engines or some particular component that needs being checked. But you could talk about as much as a million miles between overhauls while you still would have, as long as you have this preventive thing in place.
So that it would be so good that even the women who just think the check engine soon light is a cute little thing that comes on, they'd probably live longer.
Well, if the check light came on, they since they're not controlling the aircraft, when it stops next time, it won't take off until that is dealt with, obviously.
Oh, so it would just sort of lock itself down.
Right, right.
Oh, that's excellent. All right, let's fit one in if we can. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Paul Muller. Hello.
Hi, this is Steve from Phoenix.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, I've been trying to call you since 1994. This is my first time.
Don't say that, it discourages people. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, well, my question is, anyways, last summer I heard a report that the Army was making a vertical takeoff system for the, I guess it was for the Army Rangers or Special Forces, but it looked like it had two fans to the left and to the right side of the shoulder. That would,
this is Mr. Mosier, Mike Mosier's, he called it at one point exoskeleton. He also calls it Solar Trek. I'm sure that's the vehicle you're talking about.
Yeah, it looks like maybe like the size of a...
Yeah, it's an interesting thought.
What is it?
Well, it's really a small helicopter in a sense, but instead of having a single rotor on top, he has two ducted fans, one on either side, driven by a single engine down below. I guess my only concern with that design would be if you lost that engine, and it does have a number of moving parts, you'd be in the same situation you are with a small helicopter. I don't believe, despite the fact that he's shown it making a noise, I don't believe it's flown yet, and I think it has some, I don't think until they develop an automatic control system that they will be able to fly it successfully. And that turns out to be a very, very expensive and time-consuming thing to do.
Do you think that getting the financing that's likely to come with your change in status and going public, will that allow the production of more test model sky cars?
Yeah, we already have the funding in place to build three more in the coming year.
Oh.
So that we will be able to then get much more aggressive in our test flights and, you know, do some loops and rolls and things like that instead of just going out there and hovering quietly.
Yeah, when you've only got one, you don't risk much. So, in other words, you've got enough money already to produce three more.
We got enough money coming in through these options that I told you about, exercised by our existing stockholders, that we will be able to do that.
I guess a lot of what you said a lot of what you're going to have to end up doing is licensing, and I'm sure that's correct. Do you think the name, the Mueller Sky Car, will remain as the name Ford has through licensing and agreements and all the rest of that baloney you got to go through? Will it still be the Mueller Sky Car?
Well, it may not. You know, we have another. I'm at heart, I'm a technocrat. You know, I love technical words, and the name Sky Car was given by the press, and maybe it sticks. Maybe you don't get away from it any more than you got away from Kleenex.
All right, Doctor, hold on. We'll be right back. We're taking calls for Dr. Paul Muller. The Sky Car. It'll probably stick.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002.
All my troubles will pass, cause I'm shoo, shoo, shoo. Sugar Town. I never had a dog that liked me some. Never had a friend who wanted one. So I just lay back.
Don't you love her ways? Tell me what you say. Don't you love her face? Don't you?
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 19th, 2002.
Good morning, everybody. Dr. Paul Mahler is my guest. He's a guy who's invented, now flown, the Sky Car. It's not a dream anymore. It's been in the air. And within just a few years, you might find yourself seated in one. Stay right where you are. More questions for Dr. Mahler directly ahead.
Now we take you back to the night of September 19th, 2002, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Once again, here's Dr. Paul Mahler, and I want to remind everybody that he's approaching being actually a publicly traded company. You can get it now, I guess, Pink Slip. Pink Sheets are called. M-L-E-R is the symbol, M-L-E-R. So, you know, investments are, I guess, always about the future and what you believe the future holds. And I wonder what it is that most of you out there believe the future holds. If you think it's this, then that might be a good way to go. Doctor, welcome back. Okay, here we go. Just a million people want to talk to you. One quick question. Somebody asks by computer about the amount of oxygen. In other words, on a long trip, obviously at 25,000 feet, you're going to need oxygen. So what would be practical weight-wise do you believe to carry on board? How much oxygen?
Well, if you pressurize the aircraft like we do today with a commercial airliner,
right,
then you don't need to have oxygen because you keep it at an altitude which provides enough oxygen for you. So, you know, our airliners today are pressurized, I believe, at about 8,000 feet. Effectively, even when they're up at 30,000 feet, we would do much the same thing.
Huh. Okay. I guess it would treat your ears the same way. I mean,
well, you have to be, again, pressurization is important because this climbs so fast. It climbs at over a mile a minute. So that if you were to do that without the pressurization, it would be a painful experience. So pressurization again eases that process and makes it less painful, or at least hopefully not painful whatsoever to do that.
Bad thing to do with a cold. Have you ever done that?
Oh, yes,
I'll tell you to pack it in there like cement. All right, here we go. First time caller line. You're on the air with Dr. Paul Mahler. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Doctor. Calling from the island of Kauai in Hawaii.
Wow. Okay.
And I'm a flight instructor here, and I have a business where I take people up, and we use these light aircraft called, we call them trikes. They're, you know, the hang glider type wing that's a certified wing, 6 Gs positive, 4 negative. We have also the rocket parachute system on them. And they are, I cannot handle the amount of people now that want to come out to go and try this type of aviation. The public, you know, they're visiting here. We have a wide range of people from all over the world coming, and I'm just finding out that more and more people are so interested in having some form of personal flight. And this introduces them to them, and they can come up and show them how. And with the over-regulation of small aircraft and everything, people want to really experience personal flight. So this idea of your sky car should be just awesome. I feel I have a pulse on the public because of the amount of people that call and want to try this.
Huh.
I think
it's amazing. You know, these are similar to, I don't know if any of you guys have seen that movie Fly Away Home where they teach the animals to, you know, the geese and so on to migrate.
Oh yes, I have, as
well. Right. So these are the type of aircraft you're using, and there's many companies building them.
But basically what you're saying is the interest in this kind of personal flight is right on through the roof.
It's huge. And it's the age range is typically 35 and above.
That's very nice.
We find that pretty solid. There's a few of us here in the state doing this for a living, and we all have that same consensus, 35 and above. So people have this type of income that are interested in this type of personal flight. And it's huge. The interest is there.
All right. That's very clear. Doctor, I guess you're depending on that, aren't you?
Well, of course, that's great. I mean, anything that opens people up to the opportunity to fly, and if you can make them feel safe in the process and also make it utilitarian, where they can enjoy it on one hand as a recreational product and they can enjoy it the other as something that gets them around efficiently, then I think that's the perfect future for...
Well, you know, safe and flying would be a couple good words to see get together again. Where these are hard times.
It is.
Even though the stats are still on our side, with even conventional flight in terms of safety, somehow psychologically, you know, the 11th ruined us in some ways. Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Mahler. Hello.
Yes, this is Gordon in Pahrump.
Oh, in Pahrump.
Right.
Listening to...
K-N-Y.
K-N-Y-E.
All right.
95.1. Thank you.
Yeah, I had a question for Mr. Mahler. The videos on his site of his test flights show the engine nacelles mounted at a 45-degree angle, and I was wondering why that is, because I understood it was going to be vectored and not the nacelles turning.
Well, it is vectored and they turn. It's a combination, and there's a number of reasons we added the partial rotation. One was that we found that when the vehicles were horizontal near the ground, it tended to suck up a lot of debris. And so we found that the safest thing to do is rotate them partially, but the flow is still deflected in the exit by a series of vanes that are part of our patented.
But you start out at a fixed 45-degree angle, and then
as you go forward, first the vanes go back to horizontal, and then the nacelles go back to horizontal. That's the lifting pods, and
right.
Then the vanes themselves go back to horizontal, and then you end up in the previous configuration. But it's very observant of you to point that out, that is a change. It is a change. There's a number of other reasons, but I gave you the simple one, that it really helped prevent debris being sucked into the engine as it approaches the ground.
How's that, sir?
Oh, that's very good, and I certainly hope this takes off. I used to be a private pilot, and I'd sure like to be back to be able to fly again with a heart condition. Of course, I'd never get a license. But
well, you will get a powered license, power lift. Your heart condition is not going to be a problem.
All right. Yeah, it wouldn't be, would it? In other words, the worst thing that would happen, I suppose, is he would arrive dead.
That's the worst case. not due to the sky car.
Yeah, just the heart. I mean, but it would deliver you safely to the ground. Or maybe the sky car would even have... Would there be, for example, suppose you got up there and you were having a heart attack, could you press some kind of panic button that would take you to a hospital?
Well, I haven't thought about that, but it seems like a fairly simple thing to add to it if it's got this kind of...
Well, you know you're going to have in-flight emergencies.
Certainly.
You know, people, oh, my appendix, oh, this, that, whatever.
Take me to the nearest hospital.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't see any reason that couldn't be a part of it. We haven't actually spent a lot of time thinking about that, but certainly we've talked to the medevac people because they're very interested in something that can land in the middle of a freeway.
Here you might medevac yourself.
And that's exactly right.
Wow. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Paul Mahler. Hi.
How are you?
Okay, sir. Where are you?
I am in Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay.
And I had a question for you. Well, a couple, actually. First of all, are you getting a whole lot of static regarding the oil industry and how fuel efficient this thing would be? And the second question is how do you define the controlled airspace, whether or not you're going to have... Basically, you're going to have complete control of the vehicle. How is that, or how do you control,
well, right,
how does that delineate?
Well, right now, there is no highway in the sky in the way that we would envision it, but that is being worked on. I mean, if you study some of the what they call the various controls networks that they're proposing to put in place, that is going to come about, and again, as I said, it's going to be like highways. Every vehicle is going to be going down this highway at the same speed, following each other in a controlled manner. I don't know. Sorry,
go ahead.
And you had the first question. I'm sorry, what the first question was?
The first question was, are you catching a whole lot of static from the oil industry regarding how efficient these vehicles are?
Well, I think that, you know, anything that increases our freedom is going to be utilized even more than perhaps in the past we've utilized it. So while it may be fuel efficient, I think that the oil industry probably is going to, maybe they'll be threatened by the fact that we can run on alcohol, for example. But from the point of view of fuel consumption generally, you know, every year we use more fuel because people want more freedom. They want to go further. They want to go faster. And this
That's
is going to allow them to do that.
On a personal basis.
That's the important thing.
Wow.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Paul Muller. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, Doctor. I've had a couple of questions. The first question I had is, when you're actually getting into the higher elevations, when you're getting to 30,000 feet, you're looking at extreme, you know, temperature differences, and I was wondering what you're working on as far as the system was like for breaking away ice, ice reduction, whether you're doing fluid movement or using ice breakers. And I was also wanted to know if you're familiar with Eclipse Aviation and the things that they're changing with actually having the big highway routes and the things like that that are changing with the FAA.
Well, we certainly are looking at the anti-icing issue. We've got a lot of onboard heating because we have a lot of onboard cooling for the engines with liquid, which can be circulated through these fairly small wings and around the nose of the nacelles. So I think that icing is clearly an issue. You always have to deal with that. It's part of the certification process for all-weather flight, and we continue to do that. But it's not high on our priority list right now because of so many other things.
Right.
Regarding the Eclipse aircraft, I think that's marvelous. I mean, that's a major breakthrough where you're going to have these small jet airplanes that will carry 6 or 7 passengers that and the planes can be purchased for under $1 million. I think it's another form of transportation that complements what we're doing in a very favorable way.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir, and thank you for calling. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Paul Muller. Good morning. Hello? Going once? Hello? Yes?
Yeah, I was wondering about, you know, for people like in cities that, you know, are just, you know, going, like, around the corner, you know, down the block, does it have wheels and, you know, go on the ground? Or, you know...
Oh, okay, yeah, actually, pretty good question. Now, yeah, right, Doctor. In other words, there still, even with your car, there are certain short trips, I mean really short trips, that wouldn't justify air travel, or would it?
Well, I think, let me explain. The vehicle itself is street legal. It's street legal width, and it has wheels, and it's really classified, interestingly enough, in most states as a motorcycle because it's three-wheeled, so you don't have some of the DOT regulations. But it can drive for distances on the street. But the only reason you'd probably do that is to get from your home to a vertiport, someplace where you can take off if you can't take off from your home.
Right.
Otherwise, I think it's going to be complemented by owning an electric vehicle or something that is just much more practical for in-the-city usage. It's not a vehicle that you're going to, you know, want to park or run around in the city. Why drive when you can fly? So you're going to have a complementary world, I think, where you have electric vehicles or fuel cell-driven vehicles for up to 50 miles, and then for any trip over 50 miles, you'll use a sky car.
How much study has your company done on the social impact, the social, political, economic impact of a society airborne, as we've been discussing? I mean, it would be incredible. Besides shifting the people out of the cities, it would change, it seems like it would change every aspect of life right now. I mean, commerce would change in so many ways. It would just change everything. The impact would be astounding.
But what it does, and what this type of vehicle would do, making assumptions that there'll be many other competing vehicles that have similar characteristics, is that it makes use of this enormous natural resource that is really unused today. We have this incredible major ground transportation problem, and we have this wonderful medium in which to solve it, but we haven't made that connection. I always say that if we could get to the moon, and let me tell you, from an engineering point of view, getting to the moon is a hell of a lot more difficult than what I've done. And we did it, and we did it successfully. It was just a matter of national priorities. If we decide we want to put this kind of vehicle in the hands of every American, we can do it. It just maybe has to get a lot worse on the highway before congressmen can't get to the airport, and then they'll start thinking about alternatives.
I don't know how much worse it has to get. Listen, here's something. In the first years, Doctor, isn't it likely that the rich will soar over the poor? I mean, that's a pretty brutal way to put it, but I mean, that's kind of the way.
I think that may be true if you envision this vehicle as something that you necessarily purchase. But, you know, one of the reasons we don't like to use taxis, or at least a lot of people I know don't like to use it, because they don't like to have somebody else in their car that they don't know.
That's right.
But if you can have a vehicle land at your doorstep where you go out and get in it and there's nobody around, it's like renting a car, really, except you don't have to get involved in that, I think you'll see a lot more usage of this vehicle as a rental vehicle.
Uh-huh.
perhaps as an air taxi.
So then the rental vehicle then potentially would, like, take off from Hertz, rent an air car, right? And it would land at your house on with no pilot, just the door would open, there would be, and you would have already paid by credit card or whatever debit system we have by then, and you just get in and go.
That's probably 25 years away to do that, but 10 years away you could go to a vertiport, which may be two or three blocks away, and pick it up there. And so you could drive your electric vehicle to the vertiport and take off and go anywhere from that point. And then in time, it'll land on your roof of your house.
What a different world that would be. Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Mueller. Hello.
Hi, I got into this conversation kind of late, but I don't know what fuel you said this thing runs on, but I was wondering about hydrogen, because that seems like...
Well, you said they've done hydrogen, they've done diesel, they've done, I guess, gasoline, maybe.
And gasoline, a lot of gasoline, and then alcohol, which is what we're flying with right now.
Well,
hydrogen is a good choice, except that we still haven't solved some of the storage and safety issues associated with hydrogen.
What about in hydride form?
Well, the problem with hydride's a good way to do it from a safety point of view, but it does add weight that is much more penalizing to something like a vertical takeoff aircraft than it would be for an automobile. So for the moment, where weight is extremely critical in something that has to lift itself off the ground by its bootstrap, we can't afford that extra weight. But I think with time, they'll find other forms of generating hydrogen that will be lighter, and I think hydrogen would be the fuel of choice at that time.
Are you keeping in mind, you know, the environment and that sort of thing? Because, you know, like, Ford didn't really think about that when he went to oil, you know? So are you kind of like, you know what oil has done to the planet, so I'm just wondering if you thought of
it's a good
point. Cleaner burning fuel.
Yep.
You know, our engine itself is remarkably low emissions. We have shown that the emissions out of our engine is lower than the ambient conditions in L.A. in many cases, so that you can actually breathe our exhaust preferentially over the air in L.A., but at the same time, it's still not perfect, and ideally you would want to go to, hydrogen, or even alcohol is better, and alcohol and water in combination is particularly good because it gets rid of the nitrous oxides as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways to get very close to perfectly low emissions, but we aren't there yet.
Okay. Listen, there are going to be people who are going to want to contact you. I assume that contact with you is possible somehow or another through your website?
Sure. They can get a hold of us. We have emails, of course, into our company, and we try to respond to them. But, of course, you know, often it becomes almost impossible to be that personal. We do have a question and answer section on our website, and if we have questions, we typically put answers to those questions back on our website.
So like a frequently asked question section?
Right. So if people come up with new questions, we'll add those on a weekly basis to our website.
So you're pretty proactive on the website front, keeping people informed.
Right. We are. And, of course, that's one of the reasons we've been successful in our business, is that we've been very proactive in keeping our investors informed over the years, and we've had investors that joined us 35 years ago that continue to invest additional capital into our company because they've always felt comfortable that we were keeping them well informed.
Well, you're obviously making leaps and jumps and flights and stuff, and that's what gets people really inspired. It's been a long time coming. I'm sure that getting it in the air was a big moment for you, wasn't it, in July?
It was. And, of course, you know, we've had previous successes at getting into the air, but they've been, you know, fair distances apart, so it's always important that the latest one, which is certainly the more appropriate vehicle, was flown, and people can see it on our website.
And they will. Dr. Mueller, oh, what a pleasure to have you on the air again, and when you make the next leap, I want you back.
I really appreciate the opportunity, and I certainly will join you again.
Take care, my friend.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Paul Mueller and the Sky Car from the high desert. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Hear the grass sing, all these things in our memories haunt, and they use them to help.